Hello, Diddly Dum. This is Peter Capaldi. I play the Doctor. Diddly Dum, 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 Diddly Dum,
we start this podcast with a nice long look behind and before the scenes at the Capital 2 convention. But for those of you who think that there are far too few podcasts out there reviewing the latest episodes of the new series, feel free to fast forward to the 1 hour 4 minute mark where we look at Thin Ice and Knock Knock. Hello, faithless sisters, and welcome to episode 76 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Alan.
And you will have noticed from the slight hesitation there that Hayden isn't with us this week, because the poor lad is going through the most torturous experience known to humanity. No, he has not been turned into water by a puddle of alien oil. No, he has not been pulverized by an emoji robot for refusing to smile. No, he has not been dragged under the ice and eaten by a large fish. But yes, he is experiencing the plot of Knock Knock. He's moving house. So allowances must be made. Now, this is the point where we usually say, don't we, what have we been doing recently? But, nothing springs to mind, will you, boys?
I've been sleeping quite a bit.
We have, of course, spent the weekend that has just left at the Capital 2 convention. On Crawley, the fabled blue planet of the Acton Galaxy. Almost as a guest of Alan himself. And his Dwas cronies.
I prefer to think of them as Myrmidons, but...
Well, Alan.
Yes?
You've got the picnic basket with you, haven't you?
I have.
Would you care to pass me a large slice of humble pie, please?
Here we are, and lashings of ginger beer to wash it down.
The faithless listeners will know that at times in the past, I have expressed myself rather forcibly on the subject of conventions, saying that I wouldn't go near one if my life depended on it. Well, Capital 2 made me a convert. I had, over that weekend, and I'm not just saying this, the most fun that it is possible to have with your clothes on anywhere.
Bless you.
You'll also have heard me saying, even more forcibly, that queuing to pay for autographs is the lowest activity that anyone can stoop to. Well, a David J. Howe target book groaning with Sharpie ink is evidence of my conversion even on this front. And I like to think this is testimony to the very civilised way that Dwas arranged both the convention and the autographing. What say you, Mark?
Yeah, it was superbly run, wasn't it? Apart from one of the queues, I think you had about 100 nerds queuing in a corridor before we got into the air-conditioned autograph room.
Excuse me, Mark, I think you've had it was 98 nerds two mature individuals.
That was me and Erica who were running the queues.
Yeah. It's essentially three of the guests would sign any personal item once, and then you'd pay for anything beyond that.
Yes.
And everyone else was doing generally as many signings as you like within reason.
Yeah.
But for instance, if you presented 100 DVD sleeves, Erica would sort of grab you by the collar after the third one had been signed and throw you back to the back of the queue again.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's only to make sure that everyone gets a fair go, you know. We can't have one person getting 20 items signed and the person at the back of the queue not getting anything done. That's bollocks, because they've both paid the same for the ticket, haven't they? So everyone's got to get a turn.
I think I said when we were talking about the way things are possibly going with these big commercial juggernauts taking over conventions and autographing, particularly in the States. Mm. And charging the earth. I think I said it once, so why don't they just, you know, roll it all into the original ticket price?
Yeah.
And then at least there's not that awkwardness. Well, essentially, I think that happened.
Yeah.
No one was denied that weekend their hero's autograph.
No, absolutely.
For lack of cash.
No.
And it's not like we were saying, and therefore the tickets were all £200 each.
No, this has always been the way Doctor Who Appreciation Society run their events. As far as our negotiators are concerned, and this is the case for everybody, autographs for fan personal items, for items that the fans themselves own, are part of the fee we negotiate with the guest. So they're not entitled to charge additional on top of that. Now, some guests we might not have gotten directly. So I think Judy Cornwall and Angela Douglas, we weren't actually paying them a fee, which is why they were charging for their autographs. But even then, as you say, we made sure you got one free. Because you're right, there shouldn't be a hierarchy of fandom where, you know, somebody who's scraping by can't get an autograph, whereas somebody who's, you know, inherited £1 million from his dead aunt can get. That is not on. We're all part of the same community. And this is very much, you know, the ethos of the old-fashioned conventions. This is what the Generations in Swansea under Carrie Wood would do. He makes sure that everybody gets one autograph from everybody included in the convention fee. This is what Erica does when she runs her little conventions up here on the Wirral. The thing is, if you're charging specifically for an autograph and people haven't got the money to pay for an autograph, then not only do they miss out on the autograph, but they miss out on that minute of contact time with the actor as well. You know, so it's a big part of why you've come. I don't want to do down things like the comic cons, which are all over the place. Now, if you're an autograph hunter, then pay a fiver to get in and then just pick out which autographs you need for your collection. That's absolutely fine. But there are no panels. There are panels in the comic cons near us, actually. But, you know, there isn't that sense of community to it, I don't think, which the old-fashioned fan events have. So it's a different thing entirely. And some of the, because the prices are charged individually by the guest, there can be a real disparity between what you'll pay for autographs. I was chatting to some people about this over the weekend, actually. Somebody was saying that John Cleese is going to the London Comic Con and he's charging £60 a head just for his autograph. Jeez. Now, all right, it's John Cleese. That's a hell of a name, you know, and he's a big, I don't want to say hero of mine because he's a big, but I really like his work. But, you know, £60 a head for a signed piece of paper. I haven't got that kind of money. I didn't divorce him.
Yeah, I was I had a chat to Alistair Pearce and I asked him why he wasn't selling prints at the event. You know this, do you, Alan?
I know that he is generally opposed to the notion of...
Right, okay. Well, he also said that the main reason was that he was at a convention, I think it was in the 90s, and he was selling prints at that convention, but on the table next to him was a big star from Doctor Who. He did mention their name, but covered his mouth up and spoke very quietly, so I didn't catch it, which was probably the point. And he said this big star had a table piled high of photos, but they were of the worst quality. They were just really cheap paper that had photocopied pictures from magazines on them.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And apparently a fan went up to the star and said, oh, I'll have that one. Can you sign that one for me? And sign that one for me. Oh, and sign that one for me as well, please. That'd be lovely, thanks. And so this chap signed these pathetic photos.
Mm-hmm.
And said to the fan, yeah, that'll be X large amount of money. And the fan just stood there, mouth agape, going white as a sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Desperately patting his pockets, trying to conjure up enough money to pay for the autographs, which obviously had already been signed to him.
Yes, of course.
And was there for several minutes going, as this big star just glared at him. And Alistair Pearson said, he could have turned it round the star and said, do you know what, just this once, just you take them. You give me that, you know, whatever you've got, and just you have them, and that's fine. And turned it into a really good thing, a good moment of meeting your hero. But instead, it just turned into a really nasty, unpleasant thing, which left, you know, the poor fan going away, feeling bereft and disillusioned. And
yes.
Alistair said, that's something I just would never want to get involved in. So it's from that moment on, he decided he wasn't going to sell prints. I'm sure he's got other reasons as well. But,
Cool. Yeah, fair play to him.
There was lots of choices, wasn't there? I mean, with something you could have said, oh, I'd like, for instance, Matthew Waterhouse had copies of his Blue Box Boy autobiography there, which Mark actually had struggled to find a copy of.
Yeah,
so he paid extra to get those. A signed copy of that. Whereas I only really wanted my own booklet I'd brought along signed to get a signature. So I got that free. And then some people had photos to sign, or you could just get whatever you brought along signed. I just thought it went really well. just for any recent listeners, I think I ought to clarify that, well, I was going to say that Erica is, of course, Mrs. Allen. But having met her at the weekend, I think it's more appropriate now to say Allen is
Mrs. Erica. Yeah, absolutely. That's very true. I'm proud to be so, may I say.
Quite rightly.
Just going back to the photos for a moment, we have actually had an incident with one of our guests. Do you know what? I'll name her because I think she comes quite well out of it. Katie Manning. She has turned up to, well, it was Polarity Day, actually. She turned up to Polarity Day and somebody from Dwas had laid on pictures for her to sign because on that occasion, unusually, all because it was a free event, all the money from signings was going to the charity, you know, Granddaughter of Water Rats, which normally when somebody brings their own merchandise like the books and the photos along, we don't ask for a cut of that. So whatever you sell, you keep. But on this occasion, we'd printed a bunch of photos for her to sign and we were going to keep the money and give it to charity, you know. And when she arrived, she looked through the photos and she said, there's no way I'm signing any of these. These are all too low quality. I'd feel embarrassed taking money. Luckily, I've got a stock of my own with me. You can have them free of charge and I'll sign them for the fans. The money can go to charity.
The only awkward thing about it for me was thinking, while this person's signing the autograph, what do I actually... Because I can't do small talk. What do I actually talk about? Mark has the advantage of his shyness coming across as just being friendly.
That's because I'm nervous and I just babble.
My shyness comes across as rudeness. Do you sign a book, please?
Awkward silence.
Mind you, David Banks had a particularly inventive way of breaking the ice.
What did he do?
I was going incognito for the day, not as Doc, but as Steve.
Yeah.
Although I suppose that counts as going cognito, doesn't it?
Yes, because you had your box off.
And we spent a good 2 or 3 minutes asking me if Steve was spelled with a V or a PH.
Yeah.
Which I didn't quite understand.
No, I've got a friend from university who spells his name Steve, S-T-E-P-H-E. I don't insist that Al is spelled with 2 L's. That would be ridiculous.
Then we came to what may be referred to by Hoosier historians of the future as Doc's capital epiphany.
Ooh.
As we moved along to the signing table of Daphne Ashbrook.
The lovely Daphne.
Alan.
Yeah.
In a recent podcast.
Yes.
You talked to us at some length about...
that sounds like me, yeah.
a personal filming project of Daphne's, which had gone awry.
Yes.
And I confessed I was thinking at the time, where's he going with this? Why is he interested in Daphne, who I sort of, you know, vaguely remember being in the TV movie? Well, now I understand.
Yeah, it's because I'd met her, yeah.
She is a... sublimely glorious. I'm about to warn all the faithless listeners to strap in because the next half an hour is probably going to be a bumpy ride. For anyone who thinks they know me, she is a sublimely glorious human being.
It's wonderful.
It is simply not possible to be in her presence without falling under a spell. You agree, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. You can see when you see these people amongst normal mortals. You realise why they're in front of the camera, don't you?
No, she's very charismatic, isn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. A brilliant speaker as well. Engaging, funny. I could have just listened to her talking for hours.
Yes.
Her personality just radiates amazingness. I think I've fallen head over heels in love with her. I just reached the front of the queue, in front of her table, thinking... Oh, what did she ask me what my favourite scene in the TV movie was? And I'll stutter and stutter. I just lost all nervousness and just fell into a spell.
If there's anybody out there who does suffer from starstruck shyness when meeting somebody in an autograph, I have a tip. Worked very well for me and Erica in the past. If you're meeting somebody you really like, and let's say, for an example, they've been in Doctor Who. You're at a Doctor Who convention, you meet somebody you really like in Doctor Who, don't talk to them about Doctor Who. Talk to them about something they were in that the critics really liked and nobody has ever seen. They love that.
What, like when I talked to Brian Crouch about Taxi Driving?
We met Rob Brydon when he did his West End debut and spoke to him about Cruise of the Gods, which is a lovely little film that nobody's ever heard of. And he was absolutely delighted that we were so complimentary about it. So if you can slip in something that they were proud to be on, but which sank without trace, for no fault of its own, then you're in.
Well, of course, Matt, our I just wanted to say former co-host, but technically still on the books, famously interviewed Louise Jameson on stage and talked mainly about his two obsessions, Tenko and Bergerac, with her. And of course, we know that Hayden just goes up to Doctor Who stars in the hope of being able to talk to them about Spurs.
Yeah.
Very true. Which wouldn't have been a good idea that weekend, would it?
No, possibly.
Indeed not, no.
So, Alan, now I'm sure this wasn't the case, but I got the impression that you and Erica were...
No, that's a rumour. We are, in fact, married.
I won't say running it, because it sounds... But you were quite to the fore. Is that because we spent a lot of time in the big hall where all the panels were, and you were involved a lot with that? But you seem to be
busy there
in the panels room. You were, if we were queuing for autographs, you seemed to be at the door making sure people got in all right.
Yeah.
Or is it just that we don't recognise anyone else?
Yeah, it could just be confirmation bias, couldn't it? You could just be seeing us and going, "Oh, it's Dan again." We're happy to float. We don't have specialised roles. You know, there are people like, Karen wasn't at this event, but she was at the previous one. And she actually works as an ASM on the West End.
Oh, right.
And in fact, no, I think she might work as an ASM. So she does a lot of the audiovisual side and the stage management side. And, you know, if there are people with particular skills, they will go and do that. And then there are people like Tony who doesn't have... Hello, Mr. Jordan. He doesn't have any skills at all, but he did pay for it. So he gets to do whatever he likes, which is sitting in the green room smoozing with the guests.
Is he the tall guy who...
Yes.
Who did the farewell speech?
Yeah, that's him. That's him.
Okay. And I just saw him recently on my daughter Polly. Her obsession with UNIT has increased to the fact that she's been cruising the UNIT tumblers, which isn't what Mike Yates has his cocoa in. Came across footage of Ian Veen and Richard Franklin reprising one of their scenes from The Demons with a Tony Jordan interviewing them holding a tiny prop helicopter.
Well, next to Tony's frame, I think a toy helicopter would look fairly tiny. Yeah, he's a tall man.
I recall that the first time he appeared on stage on Saturday, he introduced himself with this little joke. For those of you who know me, I'm Tony Jordan. For those of you who don't, I'm Paul Winter.
Yeah.
And then there was a sort of annoying titter around the room. But of course, not knowing what either of them looked like, I couldn't work out whether the point of the joke was he actually was Paul Winter or was Tony Jordan. Which, given that they've both been interviewed on the Diddly Dum podcast, was even more embarrassing.
It was a little. You should have recognised the voice of it. Paul is the coordinator, and he's the money man. He balances books. He was there on the day with all the equipment to help people pay with card, things like that. He's one of these really good managers who's very efficient with the money, but that isn't his personality, if you know what I mean. He's not a John Major type. He's a very affable, very likable, very friendly guy. So he was doing all that. And then Erica and I, who don't have a particular skill set, we just do front of house. We are at least quite good at chatting with people and smiling and looking approachable and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, I wasn't supposed to really be on the interview panel, but with Hayden, unfortunately, having all this business with the chain on his house wrapping around and constricting him, I ended up doing a lot more than I was supposed to. And it was a welcome break, in all honesty, from standing up pointing at things. So.
Well, I have to say, if you don't mind me blowing smoke in your direction, I thought you did extremely well. I was surprised to hear that it was your first time interviewing people. I thought you seemed very natural. So, well done, sir.
And you also
managed not to get verbally custard pied by any of your guests.
Oh, well, that's Gary Russell actually said to me afterwards, you know, he said it was nice to do one where the interviewer hasn't just read your Wikipedia page. And what I'd actually done to swat up on Gary Russell, because he was one of the ones I knew I was doing, I'd watched An Evening with Gary Russell, which was made in about 2004, and then just tried to avoid all the major topics off that. So the thing is, though, I was very lucky because the panels I did were all multiple panels. So the guests talk to each other and the interviewer can get away with doing a bit less. Whereas if you've got just Philip Hinchcliffe on stage, as interesting as Philip Hinchcliffe is, it's harder for him to keep the conversation going on his own. So the interviewer's got to do more work.
I mean, I think it's a very good thing what you just said about Wikipedia. Personally, I'm so glad, because people may not realise that I was actually the stand-in interviewer for the Gary Russell segment. And I was so glad that I didn't have to do it because I'd mistakenly typed in Bertrand Russell into Wikipedia. And so all my notes were going to be a brilliant opening asking him to explain to us how he saw the light about the ontological argument.
How do we assemble a structure of formal mathematical logic from the number one upwards? But Gary Russell probably could. You know, even if he didn't know anything about it, he'd just say something because he's quite happy to weigh in. He was absolutely charming. He's a bit intimidating because he doesn't, when you speak to him in person, he doesn't give very much away in his facial reactions. He's quite a closed book. He must be a very good poker player. But he was absolutely charming.
To be honest, I was expecting, and this is probably one of the reasons why I'd never been that keen on going along to conventions, I was thinking, oh, there'll be two or three panels a day. Both of them which we'll be left to our own devices and we'll probably end up sitting in the hotel bar for hours checking our watches with me trying to make small talk with famous people is bad enough. Me and Mark having to make small talk with each other. Even worse.
Yeah, quite.
What I loved was the schedule was packed. I mean, it was almost panel following on panel. I mean, we were almost, weren't we, Mark, dashing from place to place in order to fit everything in.
Yeah. The first day, we sort of got in there, didn't we, just after 9:30.
Yeah.
And from then on, it was pretty much bang, 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 bang. And then suddenly it was like, do you know what? It's 8:00. We really must stop and get something to eat.
Yeah.
It was 8:00 at night that we finally sat down to have some food in the...
I liked how it was all quite compact. You had, you know, this main hall where all the panels were taking place. And then a couple of interview rooms and the what they call it, a dealer's room where all the
merchandise
is effectively all just in the same corner of the office. And I assumed Crawley out in the middle of Sussex is going to be a travelodge. It was this enormous swanky hotel.
Oh, yeah. It's lovely.
With a 4-story bar in the middle. Not a bar on 4 different levels, the bar whose ceiling was 4 stories above you.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, my hotel room actually over the window, I looked out my window to see what sort of view I had, and it was of the 24-hour bar.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is a lovely hotel. We've been there, we did it there last year, but we've been using it a long time for meetings of the DWAS committee. And when the capital was first mooted, 2 years ago, we went through all these lists of places trying to figure out where to put it. Then somebody just said, well, why don't we do it here? And as it turned out, it was the elegant solution. And it's actually the main hotel that services Gatwick Airport. So you see a lot of flight crews.
Yeah.
That's where the penny dropped. How can you have somewhere so swanky?
That's actually relatively cheap.
Of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not expensive.
Do you want to give us an idea of what sort of, obviously I don't mean chapter and verse, but what sort of preparation went into it all, given that hundreds of us will have been to conventions, but relatively few of us will have been helping organise?
Basically, we set a date, which we do by checking out the calendar, making sure that there are no other conventions around. We try to get it either at the start or at the very end of the month, so it's near a payday, so people can afford to do it. And avoid big public holidays. And you know, the one thing we always check for, which never occurred to me, but Tony brought it up, is big footballing events. If there's a big footballing event on, don't have a convention because all the public transport is jammed. So there's all those little considerations. Then you look at the guests you want. You go around the guests themselves or the agents or whoever it is, make offers and negotiate and try and pull it all together. Then as you get nearer and nearer the day, you work out a program, you advertise, you have the Facebook pages up and running, and you start. Tony's very good at the social media thing. You'll have noticed where he leaks out guest announcements and countdowns and things to try and keep interest at a fairly high level. And then you get to the day itself. Nobody turns up in the right order. You throw everything you've prepared out of the window and just wing it. And it's incredibly good fun. I don't get hugely involved with the admin side of things because Tony looks after a lot of the money side of things. And as far as, you know, guest fees and what have you are concerned, Paul looks after all the admin for the society because he's the coordinator. So mainly Erica and I and the other committee members like Dave Greenham, who's the secretary, Karen, the aforementioned stage manager, and Barry, who does a lot of he's the web presence guy and what have you. They handle a lot of the day-to-day admin, and Erica and I sort of throw ideas at people and see what sticks. As I said before, Tony Jordan came to me and Erica when he decided that he wanted me to do the Challenge Daffers thing and said, right, we interviewed Daphne last year. She's not going to have a great deal of new stuff to say because she hasn't been in a Doctor Who film since last year. So rather than do another bog standard interview where she'll say all the same things she said last year, let's do something a little bit different. I want to do a Challenge Daffers thing where we challenge to do something. Have you got any ideas? And I said, well, I'll go away and look at the Guinness Book of Records for world record attempts that would be easy to try on stage indoors, you know, in half an hour, short space of time. And one of the things that came up really quickly on Google was that Alan Shearer had not long broken the selfie record, most selfies taken in three minutes. I thought, well, we've got a room full of Doctor Who fans. We've got Daphne Ashbrook, who's lovely with Doctor Who fans. I'm sure she'd be up for this. Of course she was. And Tony said, you know, this is brilliant. That's exactly the sort of thing we need to do. And so we went ahead and did that. And the results are up on the Capitol Facebook page with all the selfies there for anybody who wants to have a look. And we actually managed in the space of 3 minutes, despite the fact that Daphne was using an unusual phone and accidentally put it onto video mode for a few seconds, but she sorted that out. And we actually managed to get 65 individual selfies, thereby only just missing Alan Shearer's target of 134 by slightly more than half the required amount. But it was bloody good fun, and we all had a bloody good laugh. So there we go. That was well worth doing. Erica did have an idea that got nixed in the development stage, that we were going to speak to Daphne on the Friday and challenge her to have got two Doctor Who fans on a date together by the end of the weekend, and that we would sort of announce their first date on the Saturday.
A narrow escape from Ian Mark there.
Yeah, indeed, absolutely. But Dal, we should have just told her to announce the fact that you two were going on a date, and that would have sorted it. Bloody hell. Right, next year. Okay. Yeah, the problem with that is that with a Doctor Who convention, you know, there is such a confluence of people of all different sexualities in Doctor Who fandom that the idea of approaching two random people and saying, why don't you two have a date, was just a non-starter, because it's not as simple as walking into a dating bar and saying, you bloke, you girl, go on a date. So it was, you know, Doctor Who fans are more complicated and more interesting as individuals than that.
So who had the responsibility for reassuring the hotel management that Kai Owen wasn't coming this year and getting him to check in under a false name?
We hadn't had Kai Owen before, so nobody knew what he was going to be like when he turned up. But he was glorious, wasn't he?
Oh,
I mean, I know
force of nature, isn't he?
He is. I mean, I know he drank an awful lot, but he was never unpleasant. He didn't lose his rag with anybody. And when he came to do our auction, he was unstoppable. He did such a good job.
Oh, it was incredible.
Yeah, we raised over $2,000 from that auction. And I guarantee it that if anyone other than Kai Owen had done that, we wouldn't have been anywhere near that target. So he was, he did a sterling day's work for us there, and was well worth having. We'd gladly have him back anytime.
This hotel is a fucking house!
£7 for vodka and tonic. Yeah. No, he was magnificent, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I thought for a man who'd clearly been having a very good day, he was very good about picking his targets when he was being insulting. You know, he insulted the hotel, but he wouldn't insult the guests or the charities or anything like that. He was very astute.
He's quite insulting about Chris Marshall, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he said some very interesting things about Chris Marshall.
I think that was on the panel he was on with James
Goss.
That
was on the panel with James Goss. Yeah, that's right. He asked the floor what they thought, and I went, ugh, and he agreed with me. So, But yeah. So no, I love Kai Owen, and I would I'd happily have him at another convention any day because he was a trooper. He really was.
Yeah, he was at the Sci-Fi by the C4 siding in Herne Bay that I went to last June, and I have to say.
Oh, yeah.
He was a lot quieter.
I was going to say, was he standing on the opposite headland?
He wasn't stood in the middle of the school field with a pipe in his hand shouting, this school is a f***ing house!
£3.50 for a carton of milk? You're taking the piss! No, he was brilliant. I loved that.
Anyway, talking of rushing around, we just got back from David Banks.
Inside the second Doctor Who monster book from the 1970s, which has Chris Kilios' picture of Tom Baker and lots of beasties on the front, Inside, it's got double-page spreads all about each of the stories from Tom Baker's first season. And for the Revenge of the Cybermen story, it's got the wrong picture. It's got photographs of, from Tomb of the Cybermen. So I took that up to David Banks and said, can you sign this, please? And he wrote on it, to Mark, not canonical, not excellent, David Banks.
I saw that. That was good.
Although he did spell canonical wrong, which is going to ruin my future viewings of Earthshock.
Yes.
Pictures in the show notes. I quite like that sort of thing. You thought, I can't ask David Banks to do that. He's famous. Well, relatively.
Anyway, I was standing there with my monster books in the hand, in my hand, and I was looking at them as we were waiting for Philip Hinchcliffe's autograph. And I was looking, I saw the name Terence Dix, you know, written by Terence Dix, and I thought, well, it's such a terrible shame that I'm not going to get a chance to meet him, probably, and that he's not at this convention. And I thought, that really is quite sad. Anyway, we got our autographs from Philip Hinchcliffe.
And then we disappeared for a coffee, I think. And just as Alan was starting his panel to interview John Culshaw, well, you said, Alan, no one told me about this. At what point did you realise there was a surprise guest turning up?
When I was given the interview list, the schedule for things I was supposed to do, I had John Culshaw plus one written on it. And I thought...
He was bringing his wife.
Yeah. This is someone who hasn't confirmed, or it's something we've not decided, I don't know. And then the night before the Capitol, I messaged Tony, because I still hadn't heard anything. And I said, look, just for research purpose, who's this plus one that I'm going to be getting with John Culshaw? And he said, well, obviously, I'll wring your neck like a scrawny chicken if you tell anyone with Terence Dix. So that was it. And Terence, bless him, was sat in the green room from 10 o'clock that morning, sort of genially complaining that he was felt like a prisoner because he'd turned up at 10 and we were keeping him under wraps till 1 o'clock. So he wasn't going anywhere or doing anything. I think, to be fair, the number of conventions Terence Dix has done, he expects to do a day's work, you know? He doesn't expect to just turn up and sit there in the green room. So he was feeling a bit... He was chafing at the bit, I think. But yeah, so we... John Colster and I and Terence all got together in the green room beforehand, and we all agreed that at the signal, which is John's impression of Terence, Terence would come storming out of the TARDIS, waving his umbrella and shouting, "It doesn't sound anything like me!"
Do you find yourself reading Terence?
Sometimes, you know, one of the things I always look forward to in a Doctor Who DVD, for example, is where you have in the DVD extras.
Are you Terence Dix is there, you see. And of course, yeah, this gives you know, the companion is a wonderful way to split up your story, you see. You go that way. Queen, the colourful monster, this is Queen. This
doesn't sound in the least right.
Hayden wasn't doing that panel as originally intended because we'd have no idea who he was talking to. Well, that would have been great. It could have just been three Terence Dixes on a panel. Just
I know.
Singing Row Your Boat in the Round. It would have been marvellous, but a missed opportunity, maybe next year. And John was so lovely. I actually saw him in the corridor photobombing. The bunch of fans were taking their photo just together. John just popped up in the background. But he was lovely. I said to him when he left, you know, thank you so much for making the panel so easy for me. Because he's a raconteur, John. He can just go. So I didn't have to do a lot of work there. I said, thank you. It was a lovely panel. And he said, let's do another one. So I was very, very chuffed with him.
That moment when suddenly, because I was enjoying his Uncle Terence impersonation.
Yeah.
But that moment when Terence actually appeared, me and Doc just suddenly looked at each other, our mouths open, our eyes wide.
When he was doing, John was doing the, it must be a Gween monster.
Yes, yeah.
I just leaned over to Mark and whispered, he's doing a Hayden.
And then suddenly there was Terence. And I could have cried almost. I was just so delighted to see him.
Mark was over the moon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really was.
Well, we actually ended up in the interview room with him.
The autograph room.
In the interview room with him. What had he done?
He was being the good cop. Yeah, you better tell Shoot, I won't be able to hold him off. Sorry. I'm no Hayden.
For the last time, what did you say to Barry Letts?
Yeah, that's quite an emotional moment.
Was the final panel on Saturday was Daphne, wasn't it?
Yes.
And I've decided to do another U-turn. You know all I've said over the months about the idea of a female doctor?
Ah, as long as it's Daphne.
I'd now be happy to have a female doctor on the sole condition that she was played by Daphne Ashbrook.
There we go.
She talks with a really engaging passion about whatever she's talking about. You know, you were saying, Alan, sometimes it can, you know, oh, if you've had someone who's you've interviewed a million times before,
yeah,
it can be hard to think of a new thing. But someone like Daphne, you just really have to say something, don't you? And she'll go off at any tangents
yes.
she likes.
Yeah.
Almost like Katie, I suppose.
Mm.
And it doesn't matter.
Very much.
Because she could be talking about Crossroads, couldn't she?
Mm.
Yeah.
And you'd be fascinated. And so we were generally giddy with excitement, weren't we, Mark? I, having raged against the whole idea of celebrity auctions, was holding around the David J. Howe Target book, filled with them. Mainly,
celebrity autograph.
Really, because it's full of white pages.
Yeah.
So, what did I say?
Auctions.
Celebrity autographs. Then we watched the live broadcast of Knock Knock.
We did, yeah.
With a special introduction.
Which we will get to later. Matt Lucas had actually been on holiday in LA when Eric had badgered him to record that. And he said, I'll think about it. And then a minute later, he came back and said, oh, since it's you. And this was about 2 weeks before the Capitol. And 10 minutes later, it was in Erica's inbox. Matt had assumed there was a degree of urgency to it. Yeah, no, but it was lovely, wasn't it? And I don't know if you noticed the joke he did at the end. Well, you wouldn't have known this, but the joke he did at the end of that video, he'd done the same thing the previous year, but with the Star Wars catchphrase. So he was, I don't know if he'd remembered or if it was a fluke, but it was like a little running gag for the Capitol that he names the wrong bloody series every year. So it was, yeah, it was the wonderful thing to have. And I did hear a couple of big Finnish people who had been out at the bar come in to Knock Knock and go, oh, we've missed it, and wander out. But I mean, it was, I don't know if I didn't get to see much of their Saturday night entertainment, but from what I've heard, what Big Finish put on for us in the evening was a real barnstormer. Went down extremely well, I'm told. What they did for the benefit of listeners at home was that they brought all the sound kit and the, what do you call it, the ring modulator for the Dalek
modulator.
Voices? Modulator. Yeah, and they brought scripts and they got members of the audience up on stage to act out the voices of the Daleks and various actors. And Kai Owen was in the Torchwood script and the audience were all joining in parts, and it looked like a really fun experience. And because everyone, it was sort of 8 o'clock by that point, everyone had a few drinks, nobody was too shy to join in. So it was brilliant. The only thing was, we were a bit surprised the next day that the scripts had been left on the table. And we took them back to Big Finish and said, your scripts are still here. And they said, oh, we thought the people who were in would want to keep them as mementos.
Oh, that's nice.
And I think what's probably happened there is that the people who've done the script just hadn't realised they sort of had permission to take the scripts away with them. So we got the scripts signed and auctioned and raffled them off with Alistair as well. So they made a little bit of extra money, as it turned out. But, you know, I thought it was nice that they were, I think the scripts were one-off. I don't think they were linked to any, I don't think they were out of a serial that's coming up or anything. So there was no problem with people taking them away.
There were clips from Order of the Daleks.
Oh, well, yeah, so they're not.
Is that the one with the stained glass Daleks?
Yes,
on?
Yeah. Yeah, so they're from an existing series. That's, yeah, they're not from upcoming. Yeah, they're from existing. That's right. But no, I mean, Big Finish had sort of come down under their own steam to, you know, run their stall, and they brought a couple of guests for the event. And
that night ended with something I'd never heard known before. Was that I didn't know Alistair Pearson could do a very Tom Baker, very good Tom Baker.
It is good, isn't it? Yeah,
that was fantastic.
It's spot on. He'd done it last year. He'd said, you know, he'd started it and he said something along the lines of, much have I travelled in the realms of gold. Oh, and many goodly stayed. And that was exactly the reaction. Just that outpouring of breath. Everyone in the room went, oh, that is so Tom. That's spot on. No, he's excellent. And he's not always the most confident chap, Alistair, which for a person of his many talents is somewhat hard to take. But no, he's lovely.
It's funny you should say that, because when you and Erica sloped off to bed, passed us at the bar after that, and then I eventually sloped off to bed, and Mark said, I'll stay behind for another pint.
I was thinking to myself, do you know what? I haven't had a convention moment yet, if you know what I mean. And I thought, if I just hang around for a little bit, I wonder if I'll have one. So that was my thinking behind sort of staying up. Because, you know, when the clock strikes midnight, sometimes that's when the magic happens, isn't it?
Yeah.
And actually, I was involved in when I was telling somebody else about this earlier on today, I referred to this as as the Waterhouse dilemma. I'd noticed that Matthew Waterhouse had turned up at the bar and was chatting to Nick Briggs. And I thought, oh, look, this will be my convention moment. I'll go up to Matthew Waterhouse at a bar in a hotel and offer to buy him a drink. I thought, actually, I'm not sure about that, because if I was at a bar in a hotel and somebody I didn't know came up to me and said, hello, can I buy you a drink? I would think, hello. And I thought, I don't want him to think that I'm
hitting on him.
So I was thinking, oh, God, I can't go up to him and say that, can I? I thought, no, I should just do it. Stop being. Anyway, this turmoil in my mind going over and over as I was sat outside on the patio. And I was rescued from the Waterhouse dilemma by Alistair Pearson, who was walking past. And I stopped him and said, your Tom Baker's excellent. I really enjoyed your set that you did. And he said, well, I didn't get to do it all, actually. And he sat down next to me without being invited, and which was obviously fine, and said, actually, I had pages and pages of stuff I didn't do. I was going to do Tom Baker Does All the Doctors up to Trial of a Time Lord, he said, and I had. And then for the next 40 minutes, he just sat there, and he went through the whole of the set that he didn't do, doing Tom Baker, you know, as the First Doctor. Have you ever wondered what it's like to be a wanderer in the fourth dimension? Ah! Going through all those quotes all the way through Patrick Troughton and John Pertwee and Peter Davison and that. And I got a one-on-one session with him, and he just divulged all this stuff. And he threw in as well a poem which he'd once been forbidden by John Nathan Turner to do at a convention cabaret about Bonnie Langford, which was hilarious. He did go to great pains to point out that actually Bonnie Langford is a wonderful lady, and her character of Mel is actually not as bad. He doesn't find her quite as disagreeable as he once did. He was at pains to point that out. Talked about the Target exhibition that they held last year at the Comics Museum as well, which was interesting, because he didn't display any artwork there. I hadn't asked him about this. He just was proffering. I wish I'd been recording it, because it would have made for a wonderful interview, but then if I'd been recording it, perhaps it wouldn't have happened in the first place. But he was telling me that at the Target exhibition, he didn't put any prints up because he did say, you know, artists all have egos, and he felt slightly uncomfortable about it. And he said that other artists were complaining to him that he wasn't showing his stuff. And he pointed out that out of the 60-odd pieces that had been submitted to the Comics Museum, only, I think, 38 were used, were put on display. But I didn't realise what a long pedigree Alistair Pearson had of appearing at conventions and doing cabarets and stuff. And yeah, a really interesting man. And
yeah, and always very good with dice.
Yeah, a real treat for me just to sit there and get 40 minutes
of him to yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is, and he always does a raffle off his own back that Dwas don't have to put anything towards, and he puts some of his own money to round the figure up, and I think he declared at the end of the day that he'd made £535 just off the raffle.
And on Sunday morning, after the Peter Purvis panel, we were all queuing in the corridor. Mark was by this stage in a very smart jumper, because there was this young lad at the convention, not a young lad, but a young man, should we say, of a skinny build, cosplaying as in the full Matt Smith gear.
Yeah.
And on Saturday, Mark happened to be wearing this herringbone-ish jacket and a similar shirt. And I joked to him, without thinking, in the autograph queue, if you only had a bow tie, people might think you were cosplaying as Matt Smith. And then from then on, Mark was convinced that everyone would look at him and think, oh, he's trying to do Matt Smith, but he's not really good at it.
Yeah, I kept catching my reflection thinking, oh, God, no. Why didn't I see this before I came in here? Oh yeah, I didn't make the same mistake on the Sunday.
So we were queuing for Peter Purvis's autograph, and we felt this slight tremor in the floor, didn't we, Mark? A sort of ripple in the atmosphere, like an oncoming thunderstorm. And then the fire doors at the end of the corridor burst open, and through them burst Katie Manning, trailing about half a dozen Dwas helpers behind her, trying to keep up with her. And everyone just, as she passed down the corridor, she just left big, enormous grins behind her.
Yeah.
Didn't she? And then came... Mark, I've been doing lots of talking. Tell us about the experience of getting Katie's autograph.
Well, I'd met her last year at... this is at another signing, the aforementioned Sci-Fi by the Sea 4, which I'm always going on about. So I was already aware of her... the restorative powers of being in her presence. My main mission, actually, of the weekend was to, as I often mentioned, Polly's a big fan of the Pertwee era, especially at the moment.
This is Mark's eldest daughter.
Yes, sorry, yeah. And I was, my big mission was to get a signed photograph of Katie Manning for her. And I said to Katie Manning, she's coming up to do a GCSE soon. Would you write on it, good luck with your exams? And Katie Manning, being wonderful, just signed this photo. I picked one out that had was a picture from The Demons with John Pertwee on the motorbike with Katie Manning sat on the back. And she wrote on it, to Polly, go get 'em, girl. Love and success. Kiss, kiss. Katie Manning. Oh, it was lovely. She didn't have to do that at all. To go to that effort and write that lovely personal message.
Have you given that to Polly yet?
Yes, I gave it to her earlier on tonight, actually. And she was absolutely thrilled with it. She couldn't stop staring at it, actually.
Brilliant.
She left it on the table and kept getting up from her seat whilst we were watching Terror of the Autons, funnily enough, to go and have a look at it. And was just, yeah, absolutely bowled over with it. Yeah, by osmosis, she's got some of that Katie Manning energy filtered through to her.
That wonderful bonhomie.
Yeah, she's like some weird joy generator.
She is, yeah, isn't she? You can't help but be energised by her presence, can you? She's wonderful.
She should be available on the NHS to treat low mood.
It was only when we got out of the corridor into the room that we realised why the queue was moving so slowly, because for every single person who reached the front of the queue, she got out of her chair, came round the table, gave them a big hug.
Oh, yeah.
Went to sit back down again, chatted to them, signed autographs, and then when they'd finished, came round the table again and gave them a big hug goodbye for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark actually got three hugs instead of two. I was quite jealous about that. And this is where I've lost all last vestiges of my principled reputation. I was so enamoured that I paid for an autograph.
Broke the cardinal rule.
I bought a glossy photo of her in her ham-fisted bun vendor role in The Lab.
Terror of the Autons.
I did say on a couple of occasions to people in the queue, Katie's queue always moves this slowly, but it's worth it when you get there. You know, she really does make a fuss over everybody. In point of fact, that autograph room was supposed to open an hour later. And Erica turned to me and said, look, Daphne and Katie are here. They've got all that stuff. Why don't we just open it? And we were, yeah, all right, let's do that. And as you saw, with that additional hour on the schedule, we were just able to get everything past Katie before the next panel came, before she was due on stage for her panel. So it's a good thing we did. But
they had to start Girls Just Want to Have Fun just with Daphne, didn't
they,
the first 10
right.
minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah, there were two autograph rooms running at the same time, weren't there? One had Peter Purvis in there.
That's right.
Was it Peter Purvis? No, it wasn't. Was it Peter Purvis? No, it was Sarah Sutton and Matthew Waterhouse.
Yes, it was the afternoon one, wasn't it?
With them.
And Tim Treloar and, all that sort of thing.
They were in one room. And having already queued for a Katie Manning autograph the year previously, I knew what she was like. And I said to him, no, we should queue for the Katie Manning one first and get as far up the head of that queue as we can and worry about Matthew Waterhouse and Sarah Sutton, no offence to them, afterwards, because the the queue for Katie Manning is going to take a long time to go down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sarah was lovely as well, though, wasn't she? I don't want to suggest that everyone else was, they're all miserable sods.
Oh, no, not at all. Oh, everyone was great. It was quite funny, actually, with the Matthew Waterhouse signature, because I had my companion's book, and there's a lovely picture in there of the three of them, Adric, Nyssa, and Tegan, all on one page. And I went up to Matthew Waterhouse first, and he signed his name, huge letters, right in the middle of the page. Huge writing. And so when I took it over to Sarah Sutton, I said, can you sign this to me? I'm sorry, but Matthew Waterhouse hasn't left you much room. And she looked at it, and then she looked across the room at Matthew Waterhouse, shouted, Matthew, what is this? You've left me no room to write. Janet will have words with you about this when she sees it.
Teasing him like that, it made quite clear that actually there isn't really any friction between those two.
No, there's some real affection.
If there's any at all.
Yeah. I thought he was very good on the panel as well, Matthew. He was quick-witted and he was a good sport and, you know, he had a nice line in repartee. He treated it as sort of slightly combative. But not, he wasn't nasty. He was just witty. I thought he was good. You remind me, actually, last year at the Capitol, we had the unit team and we had John Levine and Richard Franklin at two sides of an autograph table. And John Levine signed somebody's photo first and he put, you know, a lovely dedication the way he always does. He always takes a bit of time. And then he passed it on, the fan moved on to Richard Franklin. And without even looking at what John Levine had written, Richard Franklin just struck out a stripe off Sergeant Benton's uniform, turned and went, I've demoted you. But I was saying to him, I'd got a review copy of 42 to Doomsday, which he reads. He's read the Target novel for BBC Audio. And I was saying to him, he does...
Fourth Doomsday,
which he doesn't read 10.5 times. He reads it once for BBC Audio. And I was saying, his Peter Davison impression, obviously he spent a lot of time with Peter Davison over the years, but his Peter Davison impression is brilliant because... he doesn't imitate the voice, but he imitates the cadences. And his Peter Davison's very breathy, as if he's always just slightly impatient. Adric. So it's really good. So it's not like a pastiche, but it's very well observed, very cute.
If I had a tape of someone going, Hadrick, I think it was just one of these, the missing porn season.
Oh, don't. We were talking to one of the big Finnish people over the meal on the Sunday evening, and she was saying they Big Finnish have a rule that they don't accept unsolicited manuscripts. And we sort of assume that's because there's a lot of fan fiction out there and it's a very variable quality. And she was saying to us, no, it's because Doctor Who fans write the weirdest slash fiction you have ever seen. So we have to read the first couple of pages to see if there's any merit in it. And it's horrifying.
I think my strangest moment, one of the strangest moments for me at the convention was when I went to the toilet and a figure appeared at the urinal next to me. And it was the First Doctor, which rather put me off my flow. I was half expecting him to turn to me and say, have you ever wondered what it's like to go to the toilet in the fourth dimension? Done for me, really.
Yes. You shouldn't have been hanging around the male toilets. He should, he's obviously taken up his old job as a billy fluffer. Boom! Proper porn joke for you there, folks.
I think the thing that summed the whole weekend up best was Challenge Katie.
Daphne. Oh, Katie, no, we sort of did Katie, didn't we? Yes, that's right, yeah.
Which was her attempt to break the how many individual hugs can she give you people in 3 minutes?
Yes, that's right.
Almost the entire convention was lined up, hugging Katie one after the other, while who was timekeeping next to her and going, faster, faster, faster!
Oh, that's Andrew Beach, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah, and Daphne was counting, that's right. And, I don't know if there's a record for 3 minutes, but we did 123 hugs, I think, Katie got round. So that was, as you say, that was probably most of the convention attendees on that day. So she gave 123 hugs in 3 minutes, thus narrowly missing the current world record, which is 79 hugs in 1 minute.
I know, as I said, there will have been umpteen organisers and helpers and money handlers involved. But as both you and Erica seem to be everywhere, Alan, and possibly it was just because we knew your faces and no one else.
Yeah.
I think you and your colleagues should be very proud of what you put on over the weekend.
Yeah.
And we're not just saying this. We were very proud of you.
Well, yes. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mark and I, for the first time.
No doubt. Oh, what a lovely thing to say.
There are several times when you were either interviewing or introducing, and I leaned over to Mark and said, he's being very Alan, isn't he?
Oh, charming.
Take it as you will.
Thank you very much.
And Erica, were I not such a loyal colleague, podcasting colleague, I might have fallen head over heels in love with her as well.
Oh, bless you. Yeah,
because she's absolutely lovely, unless you don't shuffle along quickly when she's controlling an autograph queue, in which case she can be slightly scary.
You know what that is? That's the side of her that she takes to her job as her old job as an NHS clinic clerk. If people dicked around with her there, shutters come down, you know, no nonsense.
Broken leg. Come on, broken leg. Broken leg. Get in there.
She's wonderful.
Corridor clearing is in her skill set, is it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Corridor management.
Yeah, well, reducing waiting times. That's what she's...
Just cheered the two of us up immensely.
Yes, it did. Mark? I think I remarked to Alan as I was leaving that I felt that my soul had been topped up.
Yes.
And that's very much how I felt.
Well, you had been with me for 2 days, out, Mark.
Yes, despite that.
Didn't someone say to you yesterday, you just look...
My mum said I looked absolutely energised, and my friends who I'm who I spent the night board gaming with, as I often do, all said that I had the appearances of someone who just come back from a 2 week holiday in Mediterranean or something, minus the tan, of course.
Perhaps it's all best summed up by, well, you, the faithless listeners know what I'm like. Perhaps the only person in podcasting who's a slightly more mordant cynic even than Alan. So, you know, I don't use expressions like this lightly, but I think I tweeted afterwards at Daphne and Katie, must be the two most life affirming people on any planet.
Yes.
In reply to which, Rob Irwin from the Doctor Who Show podcast replied on tweet, Doc? ? I think he's...
You okay?
Mark said he must have assumed that my account had been hacked by an optimist.
Optimists are great at hacking because they just go, I'll guess the password first time. Pessimists see the whole thing is pointless.
Anyway, Mark and I have been turned now into people who are... What was the next convention? What's the next convention we can go to?
Yes, yeah. No, I saw that. You've already picked one out, haven't you?
Yeah, well, actually...
We're going to at the end of May, aren't we?
Unfortunately, I can't join you because I'm at horror convention. I'm judging a horror convention. This is my life these days. It's incredible.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, but I'm hoping so, yeah. So, yeah.
Well, when you say judging, what do you mean? You're judging films that show?
No, I'm judging the horror convention. I'm just standing outside with a plaque. I'll go, you're sh**. You know you are.
This is an abomination.
Yeah. Less of this kind of thing.
There's judging and there's being judged.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, no, I am. I'm one of the judges for the film judging panel. I think my short has already been selected, but I shall let you know.
It was Alistair Pearson, actually, who I was chatting to. But well, one of the other things he mentioned to me was that there's a convention coming up. It's a one-day event on the 27th of May in Rickmansworth. And there's it's called Missing Who, and it's put on by Phantom Films. Mm. And I believe attending that will be Alistair Pearson, Annika Wills, William Russell, Waris Hussain, Donald Tosh, Deborah Watling. This is all off the top of my head. I'm bound to be forgetting people. But yeah, Mark Ayres, you know, a great list. And I immediately looked it up online and went and sat next to Doc in the room waiting for the next panel and said, look, there's another one. And it's only £30 a ticket. Mm. I think most of the autographs are included. Perhaps not all of them, I don't know.
And Hayden will be coming along.
Yes.
Because he'll hopefully finish his house move by then.
Yes, he was much missed from this, actually. That would be the only...
Yes, it was said, isn't it?
The only thing that was a bit of a shame about the weekend.
I texted him during the John Kilshaw panel saying, oh, Terrence Dix has just walked in. Sent it to him and just realised as soon as I'd pressed send that this is the most incredibly tactless thing to do.
That was the panel he was supposed to do.
Hayden was supposed to be sharing that panel.
Yeah.
It may even become like a fix.
Oh, a convention fix?
Yes, you might bump into me or Mark and see us sweating and shaking. Say, what's wrong? Oh, I need a soul top-up.
Yeah.
I need a hug from a star.
Going back just briefly to what I was saying about James Gossie's pirate project, I have, you will recall, Faithful Sisters, that at the last podcast I mentioned, I was in the middle of reading it. I've finished it as for the convention. And if you've not read it, read it.
Oh, it's good, isn't it?
Because it is. It's amazing. Mm. I think that, and no insults to any other writers, and I'm leaving aside simple genius like Sir Terence, but I think that and his City of Death are probably the two best novelizations I've ever read. And there's a long, either an appendix or an afterword at the end of it, where he explains how he went through all Douglas Adams' papers. Looking at the university at St John's College, Cambridge, possibly, and they've got all his papers where he's drafting Pirate Planet, and it's the first draft, which almost doesn't resemble at all, except in a few ways, what actually went out on TV. This was round about just before Hitchhikers first went on the radio. He says, if you read it, half of it is stuff that you think, that sounds very familiar. Oh, that's all stuff that was in later Hitchhikers books. All those ideas.
Well, he was saying on his panel, James Goss, wasn't he, that there's a Cricket Men book in the works, and it's not what wound up in Life, the Universe and everything. It's something quite different. So I'm actually looking forward to that. As I say, I haven't read James Gossie's book, so I didn't know about that appendix.
Oh, that's what he found. Yes.
Yeah.
He found in the papers a treatment for the Cricket Men.
Yeah, looking forward to that. I have heard the audio, obviously, with John Coleshaw, and I think it's an incredible achievement by James Goss, because I didn't spot James Goss in it at all. It all sounds very much like Douglas Adams, you know, so he's done very well. It's a very ego-free performance by James Goss, I think. Oh, hang on. Just before, I've got to share this with you, just for that. Guess what happened to me at the convention? I was only recognised by somebody. It's only happened to me once before in my life. I was in the Liverpool Playhouse once, and a guy came up to me and said, weren't you in Breeze Block Park in, you know, on the Wirral? And I said, yes, I was. He said, yeah, I thought so. My girlfriend was the lead in that. Yeah, fuck. Doesn't count then, does it? But a chap came up to me.
I thought this was the name of some council estate you lived on.
No, Breeze Block Park by William Russell. If you've not seen it, check it out. It's hilarious.
Breeze Block Park is a bit of a tactless name for a council estate.
bit of a giveaway, isn't it? Yeah. What happened was, when I was sat in the bar talking to some people from Big Finish, and a chap came over to me and said, are you Alan Lear of Alan Lear fame? And I said, yes, but by the same token, no. and he said, you reviewed a book for the Slaughtered Bird website. I'm one of the contributors to that book. And I went, what book? Oh, the, what was it called now? Secret, which one were you? And he told me his name. And this light in the back of my head went, bing, it's okay. His was one of the good ones. So. I was quite fantastic. Nice to meet you. I hope you like the any sequels. No. So for a tiny fraction of time, I was actually being treated like one of the guests at that.
Oh,
he didn't actually say, "Are you Alan Lear from the Diddly Dumb podcast?"
No, he didn't. He said of Alan Lear fame, which suggests that he may be familiar with the podcast. If you wish to read it like that, the book is called Secret Invasion. It's Lovecraftian Tales from the West Company. There we go.
Coming back to winding up now with some trivial things that have been happening as well. Over the last 2 weeks, we've had episodes 3 and 4 of season 10 of Doctor Who, Thin Ice and Knock Knock. So, starting with Thin Ice, Alan, would you like to start off with some views on it?
Yeah, overall, I liked it. I loved the setting. I thought it was gorgeous. It was so beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful bit of real history, the Great Frost Fairs.
Yes.
I adore that sort of thing. There was a slight historical problem for me when Bill says, this is 18... When was it? 1819?
1814, wasn't it?
1814, yeah. Slavery is still a thing. And I was saying, well, not in bloody England it isn't. Thank you very much. It was outlawed by the courts in 1772, I think you'll find. But, I mean, that's not to say that the attitudes towards race that were on display in that episode weren't still very much in evidence, obviously. So, I mean, the broader point still stands.
But she was fortunate, of course, that it was only among upper-class industrialists who disliked black people. Everyone else in the country... Now, God knows who was crewing these slaver ships, but everyone else in the country seemed to be perfectly okay, that's what I'm looking for.
I think the thing about that is it was set in London, and you see that effect in London even today, that it's, you know... You only have to look at how much of London voted Remain compared to the rest of the country.
Yes.
You know, London is a cosmopolitan city where people of many races rub elbows together. And because they're all, you know, everybody gets on with each other, it turns out none of them are eating each other's children. They're all just people like everybody else. And certainly the more isolated people get, the more weird they get about people who aren't like them, I think. But then, you know, I come from near Liverpool, which is a port city, and most port cities are fairly cosmopolitan as well, for the simple reason that you have people of all races coming in and out of the docks all the time.
Although I do think the average street market scene on a 2017 episode of EastEnders probably has a higher proportion of white faces than were in at that frost fair.
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah, I think it's probably more historically accurate than certain people would like us to think. And, you know, I know a lot of people complained about Peter Capaldi punching that bloke in the face. But come on, he's a doctor. This is not... Yeah, well, wouldn't you? Exactly. Even if you weren't a paragon of universal justice, wouldn't you just that bloke? But, yeah, no, I thought it was fantastic. And it's, you know, it's a wonderfully slimy portrayal by that guy. I don't know his name, but he usually
Nicholas
plays... Nicholas
Burns.
Thank you very much. He was in Benidorm, wasn't he, opposite Sheridan Smith? And he usually plays sort of slightly ineffectual Tim Nice but Thim style characters. So it's a bit of a departure for him. And I thought he was very effective. And in fact, I think it was all pretty well acted. I've said before that the quality of child actors seems to be increasing exponentially these days. And, you know, that even quite young children are nowhere near as embarrassing to a production as they used to be when I was a kid. Which is, you know, when I was a child, I always hated child act.
I wonder if it's significant that most children that you have in New Who, mostly, and I think we're mainly talking, aren't we, about Empty Child and this. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's just a coincidence, but they've been the street urchin types rather than little Lord Fauntleroy types, haven't they? Which maybe militates against the tendency of stage school.
Prissiness.
Oh, mummy.
Yeah, quite, yeah.
Yeah, in one of the... Frankenstein films, there's an awful one of the universal black and white Frankenstein films, there's a small boy who actually looks like a young Stephen Moffat, and he's absolutely unbearable.
Who, the small boy or Stephen Moffat?
I think in general child actors seem to be improving. I don't know what it is, maybe it's better methods of education, I don't know, but yeah, I mean, I thought they were all pretty sound. I think overall, Thin Ice was a quality production. And it's nice. I like a nice... I'm a science fiction fan myself. Mm. I'm not a huge fan of the historicals. Although history is very interesting. And if you choose a setting like the Frost Fairs, then, you know, that's certainly more interesting than the 40,000th retread of the Second World War. But, I like that as a setting, even though it's not my usual sort of thing. And the monster was a bit neither here nor there, but... Who cares? The character interaction is all very... Bill continues to impress. I'm still liking Pearl Mackie very much and her relationship with the Doctor. We still aren't getting enough Matt Lucas, but he tells us that is about to change with the next episode. So, and what we are getting, that was in the video, you may remember, the one he sent us, he says, as of episode 5, it's not... And what we are getting of Nardole is less comic relief and more serious...
Telling the Doctor off for not taking things seriously.
Exactly. So I think we're ramping up to some more impressive stuff with Nardole in it. And certainly, you know, some of the bits that we've seen down the line, he looks like he's going to get some more meaty dramatic stuff to do later on as well. So I think all in all, Thin Ice was a success for me, I have to say. I think that to date, the standard of this series of Who has been very high, and there hasn't been one that really disappointed me yet. So, yeah, I'll wrap that up just by saying I think that continues a bit of a winning streak for this series.
I have heard some people say, oh, it's been because this giant fish beneath the Thames was technically of Earth origin. This is the first pure historical since Black Orchid. But I think you could argue, couldn't you, that if in the Crusades, Saladin had been trying to win the Crusades by the fact he had a Tyrannosaurus Rex that had survived. So the Cretaceous War or wherever, that would be technically a pure historical. I don't think it would count, really, would it?
No,
very true.
Mark, what thought you of Thin Ice?
Much like Alan said, I'm far more about the science fiction episodes normally. What I think with historicals is that, to me, they're like baked potatoes, in that I never really fancy one. I wouldn't pick one off the menu. And yet when I find ones put down in front of me and I'm hungry, I really enjoy it. And I'd say that's pretty much how this... So I was surprisingly pleased with this episode, actually. It wasn't as boring or turgid as I thought it might be. In fact, in honour of Nicholas Burns, who plays Lord Sutcliffe, I would describe this episode in two words, which is Well Jackson, which you may recognise if you know Nathan Barley at all, which is
a
TV programme from 2005 that was created by Chris Morris and Charlie Brooker. It's an excellent comedy, very dark, highly recommended. But yeah, Well Jackson.
Features a pre-Boosh Julian Barrett, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Brilliant.
Yeah.
I think this is the first episode, the ones I'd watched, of the first three, that finally gave me that warm, fuzzy Doctor Who feeling that I get whilst watching it. And ironically, unlike Smile, I found myself smiling all the way through it.
So I don't think it's obligatory, but I think it's possibly easier to get that if they're, instead of being in, you know, modern clothing like a hoodie, if they are, you know, if the Doctor's in a top hat and tails, and she's in a sort of, not exactly a ball gown, you know what I mean? Maybe it's easier to get that the warm, fluffy
Doctor
Who that we remember feeling.
Yeah, I agree with Alan. It all looks gorgeous. I thought the music was good again. I think they seem to be doing subtler things with the music in this series.
Oh, and I could hear the dialogue.
Yes,
over the music.
I envy you.
Just picking up on what you've said about the costume, I thought that was quite a 12th Doctor-y touch. That whereas the Ninth Doctor would kind of just parade around in whatever they happen to wear, the 12th Doctor would insist that you got it right for the sake of historical accuracy, if for no other reason, which fit in with his kind of pedagogical relationship with Bill.
Yeah, that relationship between Bill and the Doctor is, I thought, really came to the fore in this episode as well. Whereas before, I know... In our last episode, I complained about Bill's questioning, saying I found it tiresome and grating. Whereas in this episode, I found it was it added to the story and it furthered their relationship. It threw up new dramatic elements in their relationship, which I don't think the, why are the seats over there? Why don't you have the seats here? But, you know, which was, I don't mean to keep comparing it to Smile because that's going to get a bit boring, but I thought the script was a lot better. And didn't it seem like both actors were really enjoying themselves? I thought that really came across as well.
There's a point where they first go down onto the ice. They're going down this little sort of semi-spiral staircase down to the side of the bridge, down to the ice. And he's skipping down in front of a few steps in front of him. He just glances back at her with a big grin on his face.
Yeah.
At her. I think it's always cool, isn't it fun? And I thought, oh, I love that.
Yeah.
The chemistry really clicked, didn't it?
And as Mark says, when that grin burst out, you did get the feeling that there was an element of Peter Capaldi himself genuinely going, this is what I signed up for.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I bet it was just an ad-lib, if you can ad-lib a smile.
I thought for large chunks of this that I could have seen the Fourth Doctor in this role as well. His interaction with the children, his punching Nathan Barley, Nicholas Burns. Mm. Lots of it I could see the Fourth Doctor inhabiting that role, which I really enjoyed. The comedy worked, which I didn't feel it did last time out.
Comedy is difficult to judge for a family show.
Yeah. Sarah Dollard, I think, has done a bang-up script. The Doctor had some brilliant lines, didn't he? His speech, which ended with, "That's what defines an age, that's what defines a species," was absolutely superb.
Yes.
And Bill's response to it was really lovely.
Mm. I was slightly annoyed by the way that they kept referring back to it as a great speech. It's like, yes, all right.
Yeah.
It was like the writer needed a pat on the back, you know. But, yeah, but no, you're right. The speech itself was quite a...
And there was lots of lovely lines, even if they were complete lies. Like, for instance, "I've never had the time for the luxury of outrage," and "Passion fights, reason wins." You know, I loved all those touches.
That is a lie, isn't it? To be fair, the one about never having the time for luxury of outrage is outed as a lie.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the actual show. So,
but...
And no, actually, he says "passion fights, reason wins" before he slugs.
Yeah, that's right. That's
so right. Actually, they're both outed as lies, aren't they?
Exactly.
Yeah, so... to be fair, yeah.
Bill's questioning in this one, like I said, I thought furthered the relationship between them. And I thought it was a lot of her questions were very pointed and very...
Do you mean the killing people, reacting to people being killed? Yeah, rather than the, oh, look, the seats aren't...
Yeah. Look, a kitchen.
Yeah. Tumbleweed. But sorry, David. Yeah, her questioning seemed a lot more sort of germane and plot-centred. Rather than her asking the questions nobody's ever asked because nobody's ever cared to know the answer.
Yeah, and I think that also led to, perhaps, at the end, he gives her the choice of what to do with Tiny, doesn't he? And he says, "It's your decision, you're the boss." And I think that's related to the questions. I think it helps let her see how he makes the difficult decisions that he makes.
Mm.
So thereby letting her answer those questions herself to a degree.
Yes. It reminds you of, there's that sort of element of judgment there, isn't it? And it's about what gives the Doctor the right to make these decisions for humanity.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of the scene very early in the book Masquerade by Terry Pratchett, where Granny Weatherwax is visiting a pregnant woman who's been kicked in the stomach by a cat. And essentially she says, "She saves one life and only one." And the midwife wants to go and put the question, "Which one?" to the woman's husband. And Granny Weatherwax tells her not. And she's, you know, the midwife is saying, "Well, hasn't he got a right to make that decision?" And Granny Weatherwax says to her, "Do you think he's a bad man?" "No." "Well, then what's he ever done to me that I should hurt him like that?" Sometimes the decision has to be taken away from people who are too close to them, you know? which is what doctors are for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm enjoying the fact that this doctor's being light-fingered as well. I like that. He enjoys sleight of hand and stuff. That's, I think, the first time we see that's probably Listen, isn't it, with the coffee cup?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I like seeing that being brought to the fore here.
And actually, that's got a... There's a bit of an echo there of the fourth Doctor doing yo-yo tricks sort of thing. There's a little bit of, and there's a little bit of Gregory House from House MD, who always did he would roll coins over his fingers and things when he was bored. I think in one episode he juggles three objects, and what nobody picks up on is that the three objects he's juggling are three different shapes. There's a pyramid and a ball, and that is actually a lot harder than juggling four balls or five balls because you know, your hands have to move different ways.
Yeah.
And Hugh Laurie never really got the credit for that. It's a brilliant bit of skill.
I noticed, well, you know, he puts he takes his top hat off and puts it on the head of the little girl who asks for the sixpence for a whatever.
Yeah.
And then a couple of minutes later, he's got a top hat back on again. And then when they meet the little girl, they've both got a top hat on. So is he filched that top hat or someone in the...
He does. He nicks the top hat out of one of the tents, I think, yeah.
I love that sort of magician's sleight of hand that he does.
Yes.
So we've decided it's that and not a continuity error.
There's a nice little... No, it is. He does. I think he specifically does pinch it from somebody from a tent. But I like the subtext of that as well, which is that actually the top hat is going to be worth more than sixpence.
And he tells Bill, doesn't he? No, I stole the TARDIS.
Yes.
And that's something I liked there. If you bet if he told Ace that, she just said, you stole something. Oh, wicked. He tells Bill, and she pauses for a minute and says, really?
How much did it cost?
No idea. I stole it.
Seriously?
Yeah. You know, so she's not suggesting, oh, you've stolen something. Oh, aren't you brilliant? But she, I mean, she's not disapproving, but that tells me something about you.
I didn't already know. Like yeah, it's good. And you notice he lies to her about why he stole it. He's back to lying about it.
Yes.
That's not the reason he gave in heaven's name.
Another aspect that I'm enjoying about this is actually Bill's awareness of science fiction tropes, like her already knowing about things like the butterfly effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm finding that quite refreshing and it's when it's used well. That led on to the conversation about Pete, didn't it? Which was hilarious. One of the funniest bits I think I've seen in Doctor Who.
There's an episode of the Time Scoop podcast where for about 9 minutes, just a little riff on taking it absolutely seriously as if there actually was a character called Pete who got wiped out. And he did it so well. Very straight-faced humour. I was actually Googling Pete Thin Ice because I was convinced, I've watched this twice, but I must have missed this bit. Because I remember being slightly confused when I heard the lines. I thought, oh, I missed something that's going to be really important and they'll expect me to talk about the podcast. I'd been Googling it for about 2 minutes before the penny dropped.
Yeah, no, that's really good. There's a book by a chap called David Wong called John Dies at the End. It's followed up by a sequel which has the much better title of This Book is Full of Spiders. Seriously, dude, don't touch it.
I've heard of this.
Yeah. And John Dies at the End, it's full of little continuity errors. And there are bits where he'll say, oh, the five of us were in a car, but there are only four people who've been named up to that point. And then it'll disappear again and that kind of thing. And then quite late on in the book, somebody points out that he keeps making these continuity errors. And it turns out that they had a fifth member of the group, but he has been wiped out in a time explosion sort of thing, and now the memory of him is constantly shifting in and out. And that was what it reminded me of. It's a nice little use of the science fiction ethos there.
Book is full of spiders. Do you ever watch, John Oliver?
I haven't seen him for a while, but he used to do some epic comedy work on the Bugle podcast with Andy Zaltzman, another much underappreciated British comedian. Yes, I like John Oliver.
On his Last Week Tonight, I think it's called, or This Week Tonight.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Last Week Tonight, yeah.
He's talking about...
sort of the spin-off from The Daily Show, isn't it?
This new healthcare bill they've just put through the House of Representatives in America. And they show a film clip of them interviewing a Democratic congressman from the House of Representatives. Sorry, a Republican congressman from the House of Representatives.
Did you read this entire bill?
I wouldn't say every, yes, I turned through every page as to whether or not I got through some of the details in some of the pages, but yes, I attempted to read the entire bill.
Wait, you turned through every page? That's not how you read a bill, that's how you check a bill for spiders. I can't say whether this bill will cause millions to lose insurance, but it does have the Mark Sanford No Spiders Guarantee.
I have one quibble with this episode.
Oh?
Yeah. How did Bill and the Doctor get out of the ice in their deep-sea diving outfits?
Oh, Mark. Because.
Oh.
No, I thought
because it was necessary, yeah.
Even if they'd had hoses going back to some air machine, they'd have had to co-opt someone to be pumping it up and down while they're under the ice. I think they just imagined.
Well, yes, you think
just
so.
Ignore that bit. Hope no one notices.
It's not going to be steam driven in 1814, is it? It would be for about 5 minutes before the steam engine started falling from the sky in little exploded bits.
Is that your only quibble, Alan? Mark?
Yeah, that is my only quibble. Actually, I really enjoyed the episode, and it was certainly my favourite of the first three.
I agree with Alan. I thought it was a beautifully visual episode. That sort of bluish tinge to everything that speaks of icy coldness. So you don't actually know, you don't actually need to see.
Yeah, it looked frosty, didn't it?
An icy floor. And I didn't even bother noticing whether you could see their breath or not. It just looks cold. So I think you fall for it. I love the buildings lining the Thames, and not the big ones where they're actually close up, but lining the Thames in the distance. I'd say I love the outfits. For the third time in a row, we've got an episode where the plot, admittedly much more so with here than in the previous two episodes, the plot, it's things sparking off the plot you pay more attention to, like the fact that Suffield is making a fortune out of this fish in the sea. Is actually irrelevant. The important thing is his attitude towards people like Bill. The fact that people are being sucked under the Thames and killed by this monster is actually irrelevant. The whole point we're interested in is how that sparks Bill into mistrusting the Doctor's attitude towards death. It's Monster of the Week again, but it's not that bad because the concentration is mostly on the people. Not on the monsters, not on the plot. It's a pretty dull plot, really, if you think about it. And quite how, if this family had controlled this fish for generations, what benefit have they been gaining from it before the Industrial Revolution came along? What have they been doing with it?
Well, a generation's only 20 years.
Well, it's still a long time. I think it just shows that the last three episodes have shown how much... And yes, this is only my opinion, but of course, it's me listening to it. So whose opinion do you think it was going to be? It's how much of a relative waste the last two series have been. I'm not saying they've been terrible. Some episodes have been good, some have been brilliant, and some have been mediocre. So in other words, a standard Doctor Who season. But when you see this year at the heights of what we could have had in terms of Peter Capaldi's acting and his relationship with the companion, it is a crying shame.
Yeah.
The plots of Pilot and Smile were pretty mediocre, weren't they? What's lifted them has been the acting and the interaction between the two leads, which has held your attention.
Yeah.
And think how much better The Moon's a Balloon. Sorry, The Moon's an Egg. And Forest of the Night.
And Let's Kill Selena or whatever.
And I seem to be in the minority about this one, Robot of Sherwood. And the whole A Shield of Farrago could have been. If there'd been this level of character performance and chemistry to distract you from the run-of-the-mill nonsense, we've had to put up with 2 years of overblown angst from Peter Capaldi just so that we could explore this concept of the grumpy Doctor evolving into an avuncular Doctor. Let's spell it out so we never need to try it again. That idea didn't fail for Colin's Doctor because he wasn't given enough time to explore it. It failed because it was always a bad idea in the first place. I don't want to see the Doctor being nasty to people for a whole series, even if it's meant to be a piece of character evolution. Maybe grumpy. Most Doctors are grumpy in a way, aren't they? Usually towards the companion, or impatiently grumpy.
Peter Davison's Doctor never gave the impression of liking any of the people he was trapped with. No. He was always, oh, come on, go away, do this, stay there, shut up. The idea always seems to be sort of a throwback to the William Hartnell Doctor. You know, let's bring a little bit of the first Doctor back. But the thing is, the character of the Doctor wasn't fully developed when William Hartnell was doing it. That's why he nearly kills somebody with a rock in the caveman episode. William Hartnell's Doctor was an extremely good performance when poor old William Hartnell was physically well enough to give a performance. But the reason it works in that point of time is because nobody knew who the Doctor was or what he was about in terms of, you know, the character in the show. You can't hark back to that as a principle in building future episodes of the show, because now we do know who he is. And we don't know his name. We don't know his origin, really. We don't know if the Cartmel Master Plan's ever coming back. But we know who the Doctor is as a character. We've got 40 years, 50 years of evidence telling us. So, I agree with you. I think, you know, it's not the reason Colin Baker's Doctor vanished into obscurity, apart from the fact that he was being deliberately sidelined by the BBC. Isn't a failure on Colin Baker's part. It's a failure of characterisation right from the off. And I think that is borne out by the fact that Colin Baker's Doctor is so immensely popular in the Big Finish range. And when last year at the Capitol, we held a poll to find the most popular audio Doctor, which, you know, isn't just Big Finish, it's all audio adventures. So it's all of the modern Doctors, it's the Big Finish ranges, and it's John Pertwee, who did a couple of, you know, the Ghosts of Enspets and that sort of thing. Colin Baker won it. And he didn't. I say Colin Baker won it. I'm being lightotic. Colin Baker stormed it. He was 20 percentage points ahead of his nearest rival.
But he doesn't like polls.
Who was Tom Baker?
Yeah, no,
well, he changed his mind about that specific poll. He wasn't terribly happy. Wasn't terribly happy when he heard it was ongoing. But when he was presented the award by Ian Wheeler and Harrogate, he seemed extremely pleased with it. And that is actually the reason we wanted to do it, because we were pretty certain that Colin Baker was going to come out. We didn't realise he was going to, you know, wipe the board with everybody. But we were pretty certain he was going to win, and we wanted
to show him that he was appreciated.
Him to have a physical reminder of how much affection fandom holds in him, and how much his old six, as he calls him, is like these days. And that is, it's not just down to the fact that I'm going to tip this on its head now, and it's not just down to the fact that Colin's performance is so good, but it's also due to the fact that he's more sympathetically written, and that what he's got now isn't a nasty character, but a character who's just a little bit pompous and a little bit self-righteous and a little bit doesn't suffer fools gladly, but is still, underneath all that, recognisably the Doctor.
Yeah, that whole era of Colin Baker's has really flourished off-screen, hasn't it, in audio?
Yeah, absolutely.
The comic strips in DWM, which were brilliant as well. You know, he's been much better served off screen than he ever was on it.
Yeah, he's been thoroughly reclaimed by fandom now.
I like him with Evelyn Smythe, which of course they couldn't do on the TV. Could they go, 70-year-old woman? The Doctor, and having that, she's got to be pretty and spunky to attract all the teenagers.
Feist.
Whereas on the radio...
Yeah, no, I like that, and I think it's very Doctorish, the way he's got a companion who's sort of physically, not frail exactly, but, you know, not hugely spry, not up to all the legging it down corridors and generally fannying about that companions have to get up to, but on the other hand, is an extremely well-respected history professor who is fully capable of thinking her way around most problems for them, so I think that's extremely Doctor Who-y.
Anyway, as Mark says, the chemistry, it sparks beautifully between the two of them. And actually, it doesn't rely on them being matey all the time, does it?
Mm.
The whole how many people have you killed exchange works because of the chemistry between them. You remember when, for whatever reason, they had Danny doing his, oh, Time Lord, so you're an officer, are you? Oh, I know you officers, you send us all together. All the nonsense like that. She's genuinely upset by it, Bill. She's not. It's about me. And I like how the Doctor hits right. I love it when the Doctor does this. You know how I was saying about Into the Dalek, where this woman lands on his spaceship and puts a gun at him, demands she take, and he just says, you can sit there and starve to death if I'm not going to move the ship until you say please. I like it when he does that. He says, I haven't got the time for outrage. And it's so much better than, I don't know, hypothetically, some doctor might have said, I'm so sorry. And I think they achieved this by finally realised the companion doesn't have to be on the doctor's level.
Yes.
Of course, you can see why they want to write strong women in inverted commas. But as I've said before, I think TV writers too often seem to assume that a strong woman is a woman equally as powerful as the Doctor, equally as clever.
I agree. And the thing is, I think I'm anticipating what you're going to say here, Doc, but the thing is, no humans are on the Doctor's level.
No. And ironically, power and cleverness, those are male concepts of strength, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They're
being used to inform the characterisation of women.
Inverted commas, masculine characteristics, aren't they?
And I think this must be the reason. Obviously, they can't make her as intelligent as the Doctor, or as physically powerful. So that's why she needs to be special in a cosmic destiny sense. Or she has to be presented a challenge to in the fact that she's constantly moaning about how travelling around in the TARDIS is interfering with her marking.
Yeah. And of course the thing is, if you accept the argument for a moment, which I know you actually don't, Doc, but if you accept the argument for a moment that the companion is the author insertion character, the audience insertion character, then making the companion child of destiny destroys the audience's insertion point. So I don't, but the whole thing seems like a terrible error of judgment, doesn't it? But the just the way you've been talking about there made me realise there's actually a nice bit of symmetry there between, oh, I stole the TARDIS, and Bill going, oh, you're not who I think I am. Now, who I think you are. And then, how many people have you killed? There's a nice balancing out between the mysteries of the Doctor and how his incredibly exciting side also comes with a penalty.
Talking of female characterizations, you remember last time I quoted an article from some feminist blog opining that Amy and Clary's apparent angry and independence was actually a form of dependence.
Yes.
In that same piece, I read the following sentence. 2011 was the year in which Amy Pond was revealed to be pregnant with the Doctor's future wife, a baby which was then stolen and raised to kill him. Well, that's reduced to a single sentence. It does sound like a trashy series arc, doesn't it? Can you imagine if you'd come across a proposal for, say, Mark, you've been a taxi driver in your time. Imagine if you dropped off a fare somewhere and you'd realise, you've left behind a proposal for... Oh, it's a proposal for Doctor Who Series 6. And what's it say? Amy Pond will be revealed to be pregnant with the Doctor's future wife. Would you feel free to book your holidays to coincide with that season?
It's exactly the sort of thing that you'd expect to read. Well, we did have this script idea but it was rejected. You think, thank God for that. That's ridiculous.
Imagine if it had been RTD. It might have read, Amy Pond will be revealed to be pregnant by the Doctor's future wife.
I thought for a moment we were going to go there with Amy Pond turns out to be pregnant with the Doctor's future wife who will be raised to kill him in one of the many unfilmed sequences for Doctor Who versus Scratch Man.
Yeah. I must confess, Pyramids of Mars, him being unfeeling about Scum and having been killed by his own brother is one thing. But having just grabbed your sonic screwdriver from the hand of a child who's then pulled to its death, and you're then spending all your time checking that it's not been damaged, I do think that's taking I have to move on beyond the bounds of, I'm this world-weary alien.
It's a bit of a throwback to Into the Dalek, isn't it?
In what way? Oh, yes, he says to the guy, you're going to die.
And says, trust me, you know, and then he was dead anyway. I just had to find out more information. And he does a bit of that on Mummy and the Orient Express as well, doesn't he? So, yeah, it's a bit of, I think that's sort of a bit of a throwback, like he's not totally grown out of that side of his persona yet. But you're right, especially when it's a small child.
On the subject of which, even in good scripts like this, there can be the occasional temptation for the writer to fall into cliches of melodrama. Have you ever killed anyone? There's a look in your eyes sometimes that makes me wonder. Bill hasn't known him nearly long enough to be able to say that. And even if she had, how would she know what look a killer has in his eyes?
I would be fascinated to find out what this look is, because I don't know if maybe, like most Doctor Who fans, I'm borderline Asperger's and just don't pick up on these things like normal people. But yeah, I wouldn't recognise a look in a killer's eye, you know, if they took that eye out and attempted to kill me with it. I think, in all honesty, this is a failure of the education system. It should be added to the social education curriculum, because if our children aren't being taught to spot killers by the look in their eyes, then quite frankly, I don't understand what modern psychology is all about.
Coincidentally, while we were waiting in Katie Manning's autograph queue, Mark just said to me, what's that look in Erica's eyes? Yeah, you're talking about the slave trade. I confess to being, as I said, being British, I don't really have many punch-the-air moments in my life. I just raise one eyebrow, so about several sixteenths of an inch. I confess to being thrilled on first watching when the Doctor punched Suffield. But on reflection, as racist insults go, it was a bit lame. Who let this creature in here on your feet go in the presence of your betters? I mean, he could have said that to a white servant, couldn't he? But I suppose you can hardly say get this expletive deleted out of here.
Mm. If you look at it from the point of view of the character of the knobhead, he's not reacting to the fact that she's black. He's reacting to the fact that she's not behaving as befits her station in life.
Yes.
So he's not insulting her. He's trying to get her to act the way she should act in his, you know, twisted mind. So I think the fact that it's less a tirade of deliberate abuse and more a really faulty assumption of how human society is supposed to work, I think that makes it more believable. If you have a guy who is evil just because he's evil, it's not believable. Whereas if he's evil in a way that, you know, he can't see himself, whether that's because he deliberately chooses not to or not, that's more believable. And I think that it's more valuable as a way of saying, you know, these are the assumptions that people used to make that we should be steering clear of, rather than just having him be Nick Griffin yelling at somebody.
I love how when he finds where all these little street urchins or ice urchins hang out, there's a lot of empty childiness, isn't there? He entertains them by reading them a horrific fairy story about someone cutting people's off the thumbs of people who suck their thumbs. And of course, children would love that, wouldn't they? So it's like he's going to read them a bit of Winnie the Pooh or something.
Kids like a bit of bloodshed.
That's for the big speech.
Forward. Human progress isn't measured by industry. It's measured by the value you place on a life. An unimportant life. A life without privilege. The boy who died on the river, that boy's value is your value. That's what defines an age. That's what defines a species.
Well, if a species really is measured by the value it puts on life, what are we to think of the Doctor letting Rory blow up an entire cyber fleet just to grab their attention while searching for his wife? Well, I suppose he's moved on from that.
Yeah. Do the Cybermen count as life?
Not the way they're portrayed at the moment, it's just steel robots. And you're right, he does give the decision to build, doesn't he?
Yeah.
At the end, he says, you know, choose which one do you want. I love the Loch Ness monster line. I'm not hard of hearing.
Pardon?
I'm not hard of hearing, nor do I need a translation from English, so I don't like keeping the subtitles on the telly. Mainly because you tend to see the lines about a second before they're actually spoken, which can spoil the dramatic effect of how they're delivered.
Yes.
So why can't actors, and I must admit I'm talking about Pearl Mackie here, enunciate the lines more clearly?
Who was it at the Capitol was talking?
It was Katie.
Katie, and I think Pixen Lim as well?
Yeah, people aren't taught diction these days, actors.
Mm.
I suspect they assume that it's naturalistic. People talk that way in real life, but it's television. Being able to hear the lines, actually hear the lines, ought to take some sort of priority. And in real life, you don't actually have background music playing other people talking.
No, very true. Especially when it comes to comedy lines, because the timing is all important in comedy, and subtitling will knacker comedy.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, if you want to be naturalistic, you wouldn't have background music at all, would you?
Or subtitles.
Yeah.
Or a bloke in a time-space machine, let's be honest.
I had to rewind a couple of times that scene, and eventually I stuck on the subtitles where she's saying to the Doctor near the beginning of the episode, so the TARDIS has dresses and likes a bit of trouble. And then there's a line, and I had to rewind it over and over again. Eventually, I gave in and put subtitles on. She says, I think I've got low-key love for the TARDIS.
So the TARDIS has dresses and likes a bit of trouble. Yeah, I think I'm low-key in love with her.
Me too.
That's exactly the line that maybe gets like the angry about
it. Yeah, I couldn't make it out at all.
We're not going to think that Bill is secretly middle class if we can make out what she's saying. Well, there we are. I'll throw it open for any more comments. I think just a lovely thing. And I couldn't believe. It's three episodes. Mind you, we were three episodes in last year. We were saying how amazing it was until the second half of the Under the Lake thing.
Well, I disagree about three episodes because I wasn't quite as taken with Smile as everyone else.
Oh, no, you weren't, were you? I mean, But we're not saying by that that he's been rubbish, are we?
I enjoyed Series 9 a lot more than Series 8.
Be that as it may, this series is certainly showcasing Capaldi's Doctor much more effectively.
Pity we can't find out what Hayden thought of it. Hang on. What's that flickering on that screen? There's something coming through.
What?
Something coming through. You don't think it's...
Hardly think so.
Ah, there you are. I seem to be stuck up here. Oh, so you're my replacements. A dandy and a clown. Have you done anything?
Well, we've assessed the episodes.
Just as I thought. Nothing.
Well, it's not easy, you know.
It's not as if we know what's in the vault.
Bill? Bill, sorry, it's my turn with the camera now, yep. Okay. All right, thanks. Yeah, it's just, hang on. It's just on the fourth door on your left, Bill. Okay, there you go. All right, thank you. Sorry about that, chap. So, sorry I can't join you this week. Unfortunately, I'm still stuck in this time, Eddie. That's what you get when you watch the Three Doctors while the rest of you are out having fun at the Capitol. I hope you all had an amazing time. I look forward to listening to your adventures very, very soon. So then, what were my opinions on Thin Ice? Well, Thin Ice, I think, continued a rich vein of storytelling, acting, production, and the high standards of Series 10 so far. Absolutely loved Bill and the Doctor's sort of developing relationship here. This is the moment when Bill finds out that the Doctor might not be all that he seems to be. You know, there's a darker edge to him, a darker side. I think the way that Bill Potts and Pearl Mackie in turn deals with this information is certainly a lot more believable and also a lot more fulfilling, I suppose, than what it could have been, especially for the viewer. Major coots for the Doctor punching racism out of the 19th century. I love the setting of the last great frost fair in London, 1814. And even though the show has obviously visited that time period in many other forms of genre throughout its sort of huge canon. Not that huge canon. Put that down, Bill. Sorry about that. So, what else did I like about the story? I thought the plot was very good. I think this is Sarah Dollard's second script, and I think this is an improvement on Face the Raven, which is, I must admit, something I haven't gone back to see. I think I gave it a fairly strong score last season, but this is certainly a much better entry, I think, from Sarah Dollard than before. Again, though, it seems to be this continuing theme this series about a sort of mistaken threat from an alien being, you know, that isn't really, you know, evil to such an extent. The evil was on the surface with Sutcliffe. I wasn't entirely sure of. I don't think Nicholas Burns, I don't know whether his performance was very consistent. I think it felt like something out of sort of 80s Who at some periods, where it was high drama. Who did she play? Where it was high drama, and, you know, slightly sort of unbelievable in some places. I like the way that Matt Lucas's Nardole is being used sparingly, a bit like toothpaste actually. But sort of, it's making these very nice little contributions towards the end of these episodes with the vault. Now, what's in the vault? Ho, ho, ho. Well, I'll tell you what's in the vault. It's a mystery and a bit of a MacGuffin that we'll find out about later on in the series. But I'm quite pleased this time that the continuing arc is something physical in the series, and it makes a bit of a change from the Bad Wolf and He Will Knock Four Times sort of premonitions that ran through previous runs of the show. But on the whole, I think Thin Ice was a great story. I really enjoyed watching this one. Something that I hope to go back to as the years go on. And actually, I'm beginning to feel a bit more of a rewatchable aspect to Series 10. I know we're only four episodes in, but really, really enjoyed this one. I think it's overall the best story that we've had so far this series, and I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
happened? He's gone. We've lost him. Has one of you two been fiddling with the controls?
I didn't touch it. I was nowhere near it. It was the tall one.
Well, someone must have done it.
It was the tall one. It's your big long arms, your bloody elbows knocking everything.
I told you not to touch that button.
Don't wave that piccolo at me in that threatening manner, Mark. Oh, computer, could you try to get Hayden back, please? In the meantime, we'll just carry on. Mark's out of 10.
8.
Yeah, a strong 8.
Yes, I'd say strong 8 as well. Knock Knock. Written by Mike Bartlett, who I confess I've not heard of before. Directed by Bill Anderson, who I confess I've not heard of before. Shall I ever go with it? I mean, I must say, once again, we get the problem of enunciation with Bill. And Katie did mention at the Capitol panel that actors aren't taught diction now. I think she said, didn't she? Hello, I'm the audience here. You're not talking to yourself.
Yes.
And actually, it's not necessarily. Because when it's a close-up and she's having some quite deeper scene with the Doctor, she slows down, but she's not talking in a different accent. She's not suddenly talking posh. So I think it's the speed at which she's delivering. She's just sort of saying, oh, the TARDIS has dresses. I think that's another one. You think, what? I didn't hear that. I really am puzzled as to what to think of this episode. It had all the ingredients for a belting Doctor Who story. Scary house. People being picked off one by one. Yucky monsters. Sinister villain. Being trapped. They just didn't come together for me to achieve much. And it's not one, really, that I'd watch again. I think the atmosphere is great, but it's unsupported by much of a plot or much characterization, I think. And what little plot there was made little sense, which I didn't mind in the previous three stories, because at least they had lots of interaction, as I've said, between the Doctor and Bill to hold their attention. I don't think there's much of that here. Even the twist, in inverted commas, at the end didn't really engage me.
No.
The landlord and Eliza discovering that they were mother and son rather than father and daughter was supposedly the big game-changer in the plot. They didn't have anything like the dramatic or emotional impact of Nancy and Jamie in The Empty Child, did it? Because we hadn't had time to absorb the idea that she was supposed to be his daughter. And then, shock revelation, no, he's her son. It came was in quick succession. The father and daughter. Oh, no, they're not. They're mother and son. It seems to me like a story which was written to last 60 minutes and was cut down to 45 minutes by removing things, which awkwardly explained the plot, or possibly made you care. Where did the woodlice come from? How did the landlord control them? Why do they only need to feed on humans every 20 years?
Yes.
Given that all Bill's friends, the woodlice, we saw them sort of collapse into dust, how did they suddenly get resurrected again? And then at the end, it's just, you know, they run out of the house, escape with their lives, and it's just, there goes our deposit, back to the estate agent, better luck next time. And I wonder if it was cut shorter to shoehorn in the now obligatory vault scene at the end. And if, unfortunately, that's what I've got to say about it. There's not much to say, really, for me.
Fair enough.
Mark, would you care to elaborate?
Yeah, well, I have to say, this is my... Oh, sorry, did you mean Alan?
No, I meant you.
Yeah, this is the episode that, out of all of them, I've got the shortest list of notes for on whilst watching it in my note-taking viewing. I believe I commented to you, Alan, in the bar after the screening at the Capitol event that I didn't feel I had an awful lot to say about it, in a way.
Yes.
I mean, watching it at the Capitol with an audience was... it started off really good. There was quite a good atmosphere, people were quite excited. You know, there's lots of audience laughter and people engaged with it. And then that just sort of dwindled away into silence. And I didn't get the impression that was because people were sort of on the edge of their seats and couldn't make a noise.
It wasn't rapt attention, was it?
No. If you're watching a good horror film with an audience, you know, sharing the jumps and the scares with a room full of people is part of the pleasure, isn't it? But beyond the communal desire for it to not be a stinker, I thought there was quite a lack of tension in the room.
Wouldn't it have been lovely if we'd seen something like Thin Ice?
Yeah.
At the convention.
Yes.
And we'd seen everyone react to the Doctor punching out.
Yes.
That would have been a laugh, wouldn't it?
I think the biggest sort of, apart from the round of applause that it politely got at the end of the episode, I think one of the biggest laughs, or one of the biggest reactions in the room, was when Bill was asking him about Time Lords, and he sort of...
yes.
And he said, oh, did you walk around wearing top hats? And Peter Capaldi said, oh, big collars.
Yeah.
The whole thing, I thought, came a lot across, like, much like an episode of Class. But that maybe that's me with sort of some kind of, just because it's, oh, there's lots of teenagers on screen. So perhaps that's just my middle-aged view. But it had some of the same problems that I had with Class. Like some of the dialogue in it in Class seemed to be trying to be too hip. I know that's not even a hip word to use, is it, hip? But, you know, Class seemed to be trying to be too hip. And it felt like some of the dialogue in this was trying that same thing with, like, you know, pop-up, freestyle, boom. You know, it's like, what? Teenagers don't talk like that, do they? Pretty sure they don't. You know, having a little mix in there and how Little Mix reminded the Doctor of Quincy Jones, I've got no flaming idea. That's stretched believability to breaking point. Worse than the moon is an egg. The fact that Little Mix can remind anyone of the music of Quincy Jones is just bonkers.
I don't even know who Quincy Jones is.
Oh, he's a great music producer behind some classic albums. He does a lot of soul and funk. He did the soundtrack to The Italian Job. He's produced albums by Michael Jackson and his best albums.
He's not that police pathologist who lives in a houseboat, is he?
No.
Go fight City Hall, Quincy!
Yeah, and you're right as well about the revelations. All the revelations that sort of came out of the plot, just every time that there was some sort of plot detail revealed, my reaction was like, yes, and?
I think David Suchet could have been wonderfully spooky.
Yeah.
If they'd stuck him in the middle of a decent story.
Yeah, David Suchet was good, but it wasn't a very engaging role, I thought. I mean, you were saying about the revelation at the end. The best bit about that, I think, was probably that... you're right, it didn't work as a dramatic point, did it?
No.
But what was nice about that was that it was Bill that worked it out, and so it demonstrated Bill's inquiring mind and sharpness. And it demonstrates that she's continuing to be an excellent character and companion. And you're right when you said that it's a horrible shame that this is... Well, you were alluding to the fact that this is going to be a horrible shame that this will be her only season with Peter Capaldi.
If not,
her only season, full stop. You know, that really is a crying shame.
And that was an interesting character note as well, because, of course, Peter Capaldi's Doctor has consistently had trouble judging human ages.
Mm. Yes.
So The fact that it's Bill that picks up on it, and then the Doctor goes, I missed that, actually made a certain amount of... It wasn't like it was something he'd just failed to spot so the companion could do it. It was a known blind spot for the character.
Yeah, but dramatically, it wasn't a very interesting point, but as a character point for Bill, I thought it worked really well. But I just felt less and less engaged in it as it went on, to be honest. And the same thing happened when I watched it the second time round. I had very much... The same response. Although second time round, I listened to it on binaural sound. This was the first episode of Doctor Who to be produced using binaural sound, which is, in essence, if you watch it on the BBC iPlayer, this episode, and you use your headphones or earphones, or whatever, you get what they call 3D sound.
Given you've only got two ears and two headphones, how does it sound?
It sounded more like sort of super wide stereo rather than I felt like I was hearing things in front of me and behind me. It felt more like things to the left and right were a lot more pronounced. Although the bit where they knock on the Scottish boy's door and then there's a knock on the other side of the corridor.
Yeah.
And then there's a knock from somewhere else. That sounded really good in the binaural. But yeah, it wasn't... I said, perhaps I haven't got the perfect ears for it. I mean, it sounded better than a normal episode, that's for certain. And the skittering of the bugs and stuff sounded pretty good. It did leave me wondering if this was an episode thrown in to appeal to the teenage demographic that it's allegedly lost.
Possibly.
Taking a severe hit in recent years, because it felt very much like it was put in first third of the season to sort of appease teenagers. No?
Suppose we can't know, can we? Possibly.
Well, if so, I think it's probably been a bit misjudged because the teenagers all come across as feckless nincompoops.
Yeah.
Maybe that's how teenagers self-identify.
If so, they are a lot more self-aware and honest than the teenagers of my youth.
Do we know what your Polly thought yet?
She hasn't seen Knock Knock. She saw Thin Ice, though, and loved Thin Ice. Also, you know, I said about Thin Ice that I could see the Fourth Doctor in it. For large parts of this episode, I could see the Fifth Doctor in this story, particularly because Peter Capaldi's doing quite a lot of breathy delivery. Like, it isn't a door anymore. Look at it. I can imagine that. Just sort of clicks over from being Hollyoaks to horror without much of a to-do.
Alan?
The first thing I'm going to do is going to echo comments you've both made about the timing. Personally, I feel that horror needs room to breathe. You've got to build up a good head of suspense.
Yes.
Before the new mock, where all the loose ends.
Mm.
So I certainly could have done with, if not a two-part, certainly an hour long. I find that there's safety in numbers, if you know what I mean. So if you're in a big room full of people, horror doesn't work for me as well. And the more people there are, the more people there are who are going to break the suspense and disbelief.
You need time to build up the fear, don't you? The tension.
Absolutely. You've got to notch it up slowly. And so I think that didn't really work for me as a horror. I thought the prosthetics on Tree Lady were a bit ropey.
Oh, that staircase bit was...
Oh, that was awful, wasn't it? Where his foot sinks into the staircase.
I was trying to remember what her face reminded me of, and I've suddenly realised that it was the Mel B mask that git uses on Bo Select. Yeah, so I wasn't best entertained by that. I didn't give a about the kid in the room playing his music, because... You know, we hadn't met him, so who cares? All that being said, I thought David Sachet was absolutely magnificent. Oh, and what I liked particularly about the reveal that he was the sort of the son who'd never moved on rather than the controlling father was that it explained all his acting choices up to that moment. You suddenly thought, oh, so that's why he behaves in this sort of strangely moody and emotionally weird way. It's because he's an unhealthy adult. You know, he's never grown up. He's retarded. Oh,
yeah,
in childhood,
that's an idea.
Emotionally retarded. You know, so I thought that kind of cast a light on his performance that sort of made it even better. Even, you know, it was good when you were watching it, but when you understood it, it was. So I think I'm probably going to rewatch it purely to see his performance once again, but in the light of that information. Having, you know, picked a lot of holes in it, I think the central performances were enough to power the episode for me. And I actually rather liked it, I have to say.
All right.
I liked the setting. I liked the house. A lot of the horror was very cliched. You know, the Doctor going, oh, there was no wind outside. Well, yeah, I'm waiting for that. But by and large, I think it was a mild success. And I would say as well that if you've got someone like David Suckett, and there was a lot of hype surrounding his appearance. He's been in all the trailers. And I wonder if there is a little bit of the hype machine effect going on, which we have commented before, that when something is hyped to high heaven, it is inevitable.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's my opinion.
Same house they used to blink, apparently.
Oh, right.
I was going to say in the previous thing, is it just me, or was a bit of the Frost Fair set on the same bit of the supposed Thames where they film bits of Deep Breath? When he's running down the stone staircase and all that, I think it might be similar area.
Right, Alan, I mean, Mark. That thing I have about your two names can be quite embarrassing, because there was one time at the convention at the weekend where Erica said to me, I'm just going up to my room, send Alan along, will you? And, it was really embarrassing. Did you explain yourself, Mark, when you turned up?
Well, oddly enough, we're used to that because, as you may remember, Hayden walked into our bedroom through no fault of his own, bless him.
There's a bit early on when they're talking as well when Peter Capaldi mentions regeneration and Bill says, regenerated, and Capaldi's face darkens very noticeably. Mm. And in I in a way that suggests to me that that's some sort of foreshadowing. Obviously, we know he's going to regenerate, but...
I think I've mentioned this before, but I'm sure there are sometimes hints that the Doctor knows when a regeneration's oncoming.
Tell me more.
I have this...
Well, there's the obvious one with the Watcher in Legopolis, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly.
See, when another actor turns up wearing the exact same costume, slightly dishevelled.
Isn't it usually when he starts seeing his companions circling around his head?
Yes, that's true. I think perhaps it's a holdover from William Hartnell in the very first regeneration, where, of course, poor old Bill's own physical deterioration kind of pointed up the regeneration before it happened. For some reason, I've just got this idea that the Doctors are maybe it's from Big Finish, maybe it's from Zagreus, something like that, but I've got this impression that the Doctors kind of know when their luck's running out.
I wondered if more foreshadowing was the repeated use of the word grandfather. I mean, I don't know. Or is that just one of those red herrings that's thrown in?
All I've been saying about this idea is to be a strong female character, she has to be equal to the Doctor. If Bill does turn out to be Susan, I thought, oh, crap. Mm. It's not enough to be the most important person in the world is the ordinary person in the street. It's not enough to be just an ordinary girl. She has to be super important again.
Yeah, that would be deeply rubbish.
I'm not suggesting that I think that she's saying that she's Susan.
Although the grandfather thing, if that is the case, the fact that she just says grandfather twice in this episode would be so unimaginably unrelated to that that it makes me think that actually this is just a deliberate...
Yeah, I think so as well.
Tease just to put us off the scent.
I wonder if, you know, combined with the fact that Susan's photograph was in the first episode alongside River Songs, I wonder if this meant to throw in another potential vault occupant.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the main.
Who do we think the vault occupant might be? Any more ideas?
Well, it's someone who plays the piano. As someone who's vaguely sadistic, isn't it? Because they cheer up when he hears that some kids have been killed.
Yeah. All of which is still pointing to the Master.
So it's either Alan.
Yeah.
It's just, if it is the Master, I can't see why he would just happily go in with some Mexican for him.
Could it be his next regeneration, isn't it?
Well, in that case, why would he be sadistic?
Well, maybe there's a problem with him. Maybe that's why they've locked him in the vault.
Maybe it's the Valyard.
I think we thought at first, didn't we? In the pilot. Oh, they don't actually know what's in there.
Yes.
But they clearly do now, don't they?
Yeah, they must do, yeah. A lot of the Mastery stuff points back to... What was that David Tennant two-parter called? Where the proper one with the Toclophane and all that. John Sim was really giving it large.
Oh, Utopia, Last of the Time Lords and...
Sound of Drums.
Because in that, Tennant was talking about retiring from spacefaring to look after the Master.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, that's true, yeah.
So it sort of harks back to that for me a bit.
And if you think about it, if it is anyone other than the Master, that's a lot of people to fit into the final episode, isn't it?
It is. And you've got the piano playing as a distorted mirror image of Peter Capaldi's guitar playing and, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, I was just going to say, and didn't they say, is it in the pilot where Bill says, been here for what, 70 years? Is that right?
Something like that, yes.
So, you know, whoever's in the vault, presuming they've been there all that time, must be, as they could be human, but...
What is the point of having a Dwas senior honcho on the podcast if he doesn't know all the answers to these things?
We point you to the best convention.
And you... He quite happily and shamelessly talked to us on the Saturday, didn't he? And didn't mention, oh, by the way, psst, Terra Styx will be on in about an hour. So he's got no shame, Alan. But that final episode, it's very fitting. John Sim, Michelle
Gomez. Plus the Voltok.
Do we think he's going to regenerate at the end of the series here or in Christmas?
Well, the clip shows him starting to regenerate, doesn't it?
Some sort of got to try and shoe in the first Doctor.
I know a lot of people have assumed from that trailer that what's going to happen is that we'll get another, like when Capaldi started and like when Tennant first regenerated, we'll get another, oh look, here he is for the last minute. and then the new Doctor's first real appearance will be Christmas.
You know the delight we sometimes have when we find that the series finale is actually going to be an hour and 5 minutes long instead of 45?
Yes.
If we find that the series finale this year is going to be 3 hours long, we'll know that it's the two Masters, somebody Susan, else in the First Doctor.
The Valiard, a watcher.
10 and 11 and 12. Peter Capaldi's in there himself as well.
Yeah. That would be interesting, though, wouldn't it, as an idea, if they made the Doctor his own jailer as his punishment for having fucked off with the TARDIS.
Yes.
Yes.
That would be much cleverer than it being the last.
Oh, and maybe it's the Doctor...
They've punished him enough, haven't they?
Maybe it's the Doctor in the vault that we see regenerating, and therefore... But that's a future. So, therefore, Peter Capaldi still come back for that last Christmas episode.
Possibly. I was assuming it would be William Hartnell in the vault being punished for having stolen the TARDIS.
Oh.
And the reason William Hartnell escaped is because the 12th Doctor let him go.
If confusing.
If confusing.
Going back to something, I did like, you know where Bill's trying to shoo him out of the house? And she says, this is the bit of my life you're not in. Now, if Clara had done that, I suspect it would have been, she'd have been quite...
snitty.
Stop thinking you can intrude on everything. Whereas Bill is actually just quite kindly, isn't she, saying, you know, we can't be with each other all the time.
Mm.
And that sounds like I'm slacking Clara off, doesn't it?
Want to see a doctor? There's nothing going on. Nothing weird, nothing alien. Just an old house and a dodgy landlord, which is pretty standard for students. I'll see you later for more exciting TARDIS action, but basically... this is the bit of my life that you're not in. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Thanks.
Have you read the latest Doctor Who magazine?
No.
Do you know that the character of Harry, who's the young lad with, for some reason, purple lips, was written in the original draft of the story to be Harry Sullivan's grandson?
No.
I think Mike Bartlett said, it was a reference I enjoy hugely because I love Harry Sullivan. And Harry has, I think, a similar sort of attitude, a sort of energetic sort of pluck. But it was decided in 2017 people might not remember a companion from 40 years ago. So it got cut. The fifth and sisters will note, I still think it's a crying shame that Donna's granddad, Wilf, wasn't somehow written to be the retired policeman from the second Dalek Mania movie. Right. Marks out of 10?
I'd give this a 6.
I'd give it a 6. You see, when I say I don't know what to say, I don't think it's rubbish.
Oh, no.
But it's like one of those, you know, if you're going upstairs in the dark, yeah, and you not miss a step, as in fall downstairs, but you reach the top of the bottom of the stairs, and you go to take another step, and you think,
and it's not there, yeah.
And it's a pity we don't know what Hayden's. The screen's flicking. It's coming back.
Oh,
it's coming back.
What?
Is it? That's your Netflix account.
I think we need to adjust the vertical hold.
So then, what were my opinions on Knock Knock? Who's there? Doctor Who. No, but all seriousness. Knock Knock, fourth episode, 10th series. From the Next Time trailer, I thought this one was going to be, this is going to be very creepy. This is almost going to be sort of a spiritual successor to Hyde, maybe. You know, there's a mystery going on inside the house. I thought maybe there might be, you know, some kind of alien murderer in the house, getting rid of these students. The first ever contribution to Doctor Who main by Mike Bartlett, and again, I really enjoyed it. This is actually one that my girlfriend and I have sat down with, as we have with all of the series so far, and she said, I'm really looking forward to this one. And yeah, it's actually quite prevalent, because as you might have heard, and as I've been banging on to my co-stars at Diddly Dum. You know, I'm right in the middle of a move at the moment, and to see that on TV and reflected and the struggles and strifes of that kind of thing was really, really quite nice. But also, it was you know, grounded in realism again, and which I think Doctor Who's always been very good at doing, and also has always been the strong point. When you ground Doctor Who in reality, you get the viewers' bums on seats, you get the usual people watching, but then you get the lot who are watching Saturday Night Takeaway, or as I say to my girlfriend, Saturday Night Takeaway. That's Irish for anybody out there up in the north. And, you know, this is a very nice setting. I like the sort of, you know, the old creaking house motif, but the star of the show for me in this one was David Suchet. Now, I'm not really clued up on Poirot, but I'm obviously aware of the actor and his many, you know, plaudits and the talents that he possesses. And he came across as a very creepy, very sort of sinister, you know, sort of turn on a sixpence sort of performance. But I thought for me that the real stars of the show for this one were the teenagers. Now, in a way, this is kind of... it's quite incredible, isn't it, that you've got a similar sort of age range currently going out, or well, currently going out in America anyway, through Class. Now, I wonder how interesting this would have been if they had have used the Class cast. Ooh, Class cast. Class cast, Class cast, Class cast. If you had have used them in this episode instead of these new characters, Harry, Paul, Felicity, Pavel, you know, it would have been quite interesting to see how they would have, you know, integrated a year on after the events of Class if that show wasn't coming back. But having said that, I really, really enjoyed their, you know, the sort of natural, you know, sort of approach to everything, the way that they all interacted, and also the way that they were being devoured, as it were, by the house in the end. There was that interesting moment when Pavel was being eaten into the wall, very much like Han Solo in Carbonite. This didn't feel very much like the Doctor was there very much in this, but of course he was. It did at one point feel like this was going to be a Doctor Light episode, and this was going to be all about Bill interacting. I wasn't entirely certain about her sort of conduct with regards to the Doctor. You would have thought that, you know, she's been on a few adventures now, she would have seen and she would have known that there's something going on in this house that isn't quite right, and she would have wanted the Doctor to have been there sorting it out. But she almost seems embarrassed by the man that she calls her grandfather in this. Not that I think there's any meaning behind why she's calling him grandfather, at least I sincerely hope there isn't. The insect creatures, the dryads, now then, And I thought I had bad woodworm the other day. Again, an interesting premise, but again, this is the fourth time this series that we've had a monster who isn't necessarily evil. You know, we've got a misunderstood, or, well, not so much misunderstood, but you've got a sort of an antagonist who isn't very evil. He just wants to look after his mother. You know, that was brilliant. That was brilliant makeup on Mariah Gale as Eliza. Again, very creepy. In fact, actually, my girlfriend turned to me at one point and said, Doctor Who is f***ed up. And of course, she meant that in the best possible way. She's actually really enjoying this series, and considering she's not a sci-fi fan or a Doctor Who fan by any means, this is, you know, really, really good going forward. All in all, I don't think this one was as good as Thin Ice. I didn't enjoy it as much, but again, you know, it's one I know I'll be able to turn to when the DVD box set comes out, and, you know, I can actually go back to this series. I mean, there was a couple of episodes with Series 8 and a couple in Series 9 that I feel like I can go back to, stuff like Mummy on the Orient Express, Flatline, you know, The Magician's Apprentice, Under the Lake. That's pretty much it, to be honest, off the top of my head. But these ones, I could sit down and just watch them on a, you know, on a sort of a Netflix glut, or, you know, I could watch them all in one. Really, really enjoying this series so far. But this one just fell a little bit flat, because I just believe that, you know, again, the danger wasn't anything malicious, really. And it just seems a bit tried and tested now. So I'm hoping that from episode 5 onwards, we actually get to see some real, you know, evil going on. But I suppose really out of 10, I'm going to give this one, I'm going to say 6.5. I'll say 6.5 out of 10. Again, I really enjoyed it. I loved the students' interactions. I loved the premise. I did like the story. I just feel there's aspects of it that weren't very original compared to what we've seen over the last month. But again, top marks for this series so far. I mean, I'm really enjoying it. You know, we're a quarter of the way now through Peter Capaldi's last series. His Doctor has become so much more endearing to me. I feel like now this is a Doctor who I'm going to, you know, actually really miss, which is something I couldn't really have said. Well, I was going to say last year, but of course it was 2 years now, wasn't it? But I'm really enjoying it so far. I'm pleased that the series is getting consistent viewing figures here in the UK. It's getting high praise from critics. It's getting high praise from fans as well. We're having good, solid adventures again, contained 45 minutes like we used to have. Of course, it'd be nice to have some two-parters later on in this series. But so far, this series has been really, really good. I'm really, really enjoying it. And it's just so good to have Doctor Who back.
Excuse me, young man.
Yes, Bill?
Are you going to be very much longer?
Okay. All right, sorry, I've got to hand this back now. So, back to you in the studio.
Right. Well, I think that, with any luck, Hayden will be back next time, so we can do what we've been planning to do since two podcasts ago, which was to end each episode with about a brief, maybe 10 minutes, just a minute.
Yeah.
But we talked so long last time that we didn't have time. To do it now would mean I'd have to chair it, and then there'd be two people competing against each other, which wouldn't really work. So
Alan would wipe the floor with me.
Oh, I don't know about that. You were a bit of a dark horse last time.
He was, wasn't he? Have you seen the latest issue of Podcasting News, Alan? Where it's revealed that Mark is actually the grandson of Clement Freud. Right, so in that case, just a minute, fans out there, pray that the next two episodes are really lousy so we get...
Or perfect. So they're impossible to review.
And finally, on to the letters that the faithful few have been kind enough to send in to us. Mark, would you care to read them out for us, please?
Right, the first letter is from Rob Irwin of the Doctor Who Show podcast. Rob, who has one of the finest voices in podcasting, and so no pressure on me then. He says... of Thin Ice. It certainly doesn't light up the sky with fireworks or have that instant classic feel, but certainly a solid episode I'd toss a 7 out of 10 towards. The villain got a bit panto at times, and the effects of the ice cracking and his demise are among the cheapest I think we've ever seen on the show. Are these budget cuts in action? So anyway, not amazing, just good. Knock Knock is an interesting beast. Insofar as all the right playing pieces are on the board, as far as I could see, and most of them were played well for most of the episode. Where it fell down for me was 1. The concept that the landlord was somehow a man out of time who didn't know who the PM was, but was savvy enough to maintain a house for decade after decade, and sweet-talk modern young people into renting it. 2. The concept that the woodlice wanted to turn his mother into wood, but everyone else has to be eaten. 3. The concept that, after being torn apart, molecule by molecule, human beings can be magicked back together by said woodlice. 4. The concept that Bill, who has proven to be super sharp in the previous series, is now completely dull and can't see anything weird about the house and doesn't want the Doctor around. 5. The fact that an episode that was meant to be scary really wasn't that scary. Yet it feels so close, so very, very close. I can't rate it higher than a 6 out of 10. But with some bigger scares and some tougher decisions made by the script editor, like leaving at least some of Bill's mates dead to really bang home that this was a serious event, this could have crept up another notch or two. Next up, from the 42 to Doomsday podcast, boys. We currently have a No Series 10 discussion embargo on our podcast until the series reaches its conclusion. However, what I will say is that for the first time, I am actually watching the series every week with my 10-year-old son. He has previously shown very little interest in the programme, but so far it's been a great jumping on point for him, and potentially other new viewers. The three episodes so far have engaged his interest to the point he actually says he's looking forward to the next episode. Let's hope it continues. Keep punching! Mark from 42 to Doomsday. And just have this little postcard from Gareth Lloyd that says, a lovely looking episode, the story is okay, however, Pearl Mackie is fantastic.
Thanks, Mark. And just creeping under the wire, we've received a couple of items of last minute post. Firstly, from Gareth, to say, Knock Knock was good, but not great for me. Nicely directed, and David Suchet was outstanding. And the twist that he was the son was a nice touch. And from the 42 to Doomsday boys, Knock Knock, who's there? Doctor Who, of course. You see, if Hayden had anything about him, he'd have come up with that sort of joke. Well, it's week 4 and I am still engaged. And more importantly, so is my 10-year-old son. In my opinion, I thought it was a genuinely creepy adventure. Suchet was great and Capaldi was on fine form. But Bill continues to be a breath of fresh air and confirms that Clara was an absolute drag on the series post-Series 8. Have heard some quibbles about the Everybody Lives at the end. But as the house has only just ingested the students, it would make sense that the house would vomit them back up. Well, if we will skip in from Australians, the vault arc is non-intrusive, and actually I'm intrigued to see what is in there. Really glad they removed the Harry Sullivan is my granddad reference from the series. The series doesn't need the gratuitous fanwank references applied to it. I'm sure we're going to get served a whole pile of that towards the end. But so far, so good. Keep punching, Mark from 42 to Doomsday. Thanks, guys. And so, in the absence of Hayden, would you care to see us out, Brucey?
Don't throw bodies into the river. Into the river, bodies don't throw.
Uncle Brucey, you have enemy ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Sorry. Oh. Goodbye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting. Fit it in your ear.